fleeting moment. This was the work.
Conquered! Can you hear me?
Paul Farley's dramatization of Walden on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow afternoon at 3.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 31st of January. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. Email exchanges from 2010 suggest the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein set up a dinner for Andrew Mountbatten Windsor with a woman who the financier described as Russian and beautiful. The messages are among more than 3 million pages of documents released by the US Department of Justice after it was ordered to make public all its files on Epstein. Our correspondent Chichi Azundu examines the new claims made about the former Prince Andrew.
Some of the exchanges are in 2010, months after Epstein's release from prison for procuring a child for prostitution. In one chain of emails between Epstein and an account titled The Duke, Epstein says he wants to introduce the Duke to what he describes as a 26-year-old beautiful, clever and trustworthy Russian woman, because he thinks he might enjoy having dinner with her. The emails discuss arrangements and the Duke signs his response with an A and an email signature which reads HRH Duke of York KG. BBC News has not been able to verify the authorship of the emails and has asked Mr. Mountbatten Windsor for comment, but he hasn't yet responded. He has previously strenuously denied all allegations of wrongdoing.
The documents also contain some allegations made against President Trump by callers to a national FBI tip line. Many appear to be unverified and made without supporting evidence. Mr. Trump has always denied any wrongdoing. Within the files are emails by Epstein that allege that the co-founder of Microsoft, Bill Gates, contracted a sexually transmitted infection from Russian girls. A spokesperson for Mr. Gates said the claims were absolutely absurd and completely false. More evidence of the relationship between Britain's former US ambassador, Lord Mandelson, and Epstein have emerged in the documents. These include emails from the Labour peer requesting to stay at Mr. Epstein's New York apartment in 2009, when he was business secretary and when Epstein was serving a prison sentence in Florida. Lord Mandelson told the BBC he was never culpable or complicit in Epstein's crimes. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
Lord Mandelson was sacked as Washington ambassador last year when Downing Street said that emails dating from 2008 showed a greater depth to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein than had been known at the time of his appointment. Before he was made ambassador, it had previously been reported that Lord Mandelson had requested to stay at Mr. Epstein's New York apartment. Now the US Department of Justice has released messages from 2009 between the two men. Epstein suggested there might be issues with the press and mentioned a different apartment, but Lord Mandelson, who is a senior Labour cabinet minister, said he was on a private visit and the facilities were better at Epstein's home. It's understood in the end he didn't stay at any of Epstein's properties at the time. Lord Mandelson said he was wrong to believe Epstein following his conviction and has apologised to the women and girls who suffered for continuing his association with the disgraced financier.
Now, other news. A partial shutdown of the US government has come into effect, even though the Senate passed a compromise deal yesterday. The shutdown will continue until Monday, when the House of Representatives will meet to approve the funding. The Prime Minister will meet his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo later, after completing a three-day visit to China. Sir Keir Starmer is meeting Sanae Takeuchi for dinner. Our political editor, Chris Mason, is travelling with the Prime Minister.
After 24 hours in Shanghai and another blitz of glad-handing and smiles, the Prime Minister's team hope their 3 days in China can start to reboot a sense here of British enthusiasm for engagement with the country, as critics, not least the Conservatives, question the wisdom of making the trip at all. Sir Keir Starmer is now en route to Japan for a stop of just a few hours, where he's popping in for dinner with the country's first female leader, Sanae Takeuchi. Downing Street are taking advantage of Sir Keir already being here in Asia to call in on an ally who they describe as the UK's largest inward investor outside of Europe.
Well, that's the news this morning. Now, with the weather forecast, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Charles, and good morning. Well, we've still got a lot of flood warnings around, 64, in fact. Most of them are across the West Country in England, but we have got one or two elsewhere as well. And there is a bit more rain in the forecast this weekend, but it's not expected to be as persistent or as heavy as the rain we have seen. Now, today, if you are across central and eastern England, as well as the southeast of England, or northwest Scotland, these areas are going to have the driest weather. So there'll be some glimpses of blue sky, some sunshine around too. But for the rest of the UK, we're looking at a lot of cloud and some outbreaks of showery rain almost anywhere really through the day. There will be a bit of snow just on top of the highest peaks of the Pennines and also across the Grampians as well, with a cold southeasterly wind continuing across the northeast of Scotland. Top temperatures today, just 4 or 5 in the northeast of Scotland, 6 or 7 elsewhere across Scotland. But for England, Wales and Northern Ireland, temperatures between around 8 to 10 degrees.
Sarah Keith Lucas. We'll have a look at the Saturday papers now, and different allegations from the latest release of files relating to Jeffrey Epstein are reported across the front pages. The Daily Mail and The Times highlight Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's apparent invitation to the disgraced financier to visit Buckingham Palace after Epstein's conviction. The Daily Telegraph and The Sun give details of the claim that the sex offender offered to set up a meeting between the former prince and a 26-year-old Russian woman. The Guardian focuses on Epstein sending money to Lord Mandelson's husband, while the Daily Star hones in on the lurid claims concerning the tech billionaire Bill Gates, which he has strongly denied. The Daily Mirror leads with claims relating to Donald Trump that the Department of Justice has described as unfounded and false. FT Weekend says Donald Trump's choice to take over as the chair of the Federal Reserve, Kevin Warsh, has buoyed confidence in the dollar. The paper says that he's well regarded on Wall Street and his nomination will ease worries over the president's relentless campaign to force the Fed to lower borrowing rates. The much-hyped documentary about Melania Trump, produced by Melania Trump, wasn't shown to reviewers before its release, so this morning's papers give critics their first chance to talk about the film itself. More outfit changes than The Devil Wears Prada, but we're no nearer unravelling the mystery that is Melania Trump, is the review of The Mail. The movie is just boring, concludes The Times. The Telegraph describes it as Melania's North Korean-style propaganda served ice cool with a dash of Ralph Lauren. 2 hours of Melania feels like pure, endless hell, is how The Guardian ends its zero-star review. A look at some of Saturday's newspapers. This is BBC Radio 4. The time is 6:07. Time now for Claire Balding with this week's Ramblings.
I can hear the rushing of the stream.
Yes.
What is it?
So it's a little brook, which is called the Ingle. So this is known as Sheep Wash. It's not quite a winter bourne, but it does dry up, you know, in the summer.
Oh, it gives off a lot of noise for its size. It's actually tiny. Yeah. Tiny little rivulet coming under a tree trunk that is leaning right across at a precarious angle. And the river is rushing down from left to right and creating a foamy pool. We're walking down a country lane in West Berkshire on the outskirts of a village called Inkpen, which is not far away from where I grew up. It's about probably 8-9 miles from Kingsclere. And Nicola Chester is alongside me. We're walking steadily, Nicola, because you're carrying an injury.
I am. So I broke my leg at the very beginning of November. It was a case of the zoomies. Not my zoomies, but my young dog, Mum's lovely big black Labrador, who's only a year old, met a whippet in the woods, and the zoomies happened. And I remember turning to Mum to say, watch out, and the next thing I was in the air. So I broke my leg just above the ankle.
Oh. So did you spend all Christmas in plaster crutches?
Pretty much. Oh. I had it in plaster for a week and then in a boot for 7 weeks. So it was off sort of Christmas Eve, I think. Yeah, I was able to help with the Christmas dinner. I should have had it on for an extra day, I think.
Consequently, on a grey winter's day, and it's been raining heavily this morning, we are going to be safe and secure. You were planning to take me up Inkpen Beacon, weren't you?
Yes,
which we always used to call Beacon Hill.
Yeah, oh, right.
As kids.
Okay.
And I remember going up there when I was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, and just going, I thought it was a mountain. And it was so hard, and I didn't want to walk again for ages. I've got over that now.
And in fact, it used to be classed as a mountain.
Did it?
Warbury Hill, which is its other name. and it's 26 feet short of a mountain, if the mountain is 1,000 feet, which it probably isn't really.
Oh.
But it's a nice little claim to fame.
But because of your injury, we shall admire it from afar.
Yes, yeah.
And stay low, is that
stay low, yeah. Yeah. But we've got lots of lovely things to see.
We've got grazing fields to the left and the right and narrow bands of trees. And actually, if I turn around, we walked through a wood.
Yes.
Barbed wire fencing with wooden posts in between, looks relatively new and in very good condition.
It's a well-maintained farm. And this is Manor Farm that does feature in my book, Ghosts of the Farm.
Ghosts of the Farm, which is your latest book, and you've written a lot about this area, about landscape, about history. And Ghosts of the Farm intertwines two stories of you and your dream of being a farmer, and female farmers in the Second World War, who then were sort of written out again.
Yes.
So the gate opened and it slammed very firmly shut.
That's right. The repercussions of that farm gate shutting on women after the war has lasted and lasted until recently.
There is a very warm glow to Manor Farm because of the red brick, interspersed occasionally with darker grey brick and red tile roofs with beautiful edging. And it, as you say, a well-maintained farm. And yes, there are the modern barn buildings on the left, but the structure of the main bit of it and the farmhouse, you can feel the ghosts. You can see them. And there's a little duck pond with some Canada geese lying on the bank on the far side and a willow tree. Obviously, no leaves on it at the moment, but dangling its thin branches over the water. Very good gravel. Look at that gravel drive and turning circle.
Crunch.
Very nice. It is.
But it's beautiful. And I think what I love about it is I can still see the old farm, as you say. And I got to visit the family. They invited me in when I told them I was writing the book. Really accommodating, really lovely. Took me around to see the granary, where in World War II there was a store for the village. So if the village came under siege, there was a store of food there. And what I find incredible is that all of Miss White, who owned the farm and ran it, and all her men knew this store was there, didn't dare touch it.
Wow.
And they were hungry. You know, everybody was hungry in the Second World War. But the idea that we would still resist.
And also the vital importance of the rural economy, of farming, of producing enough food to feed a nation that was under siege.
Yes.
And that couldn't get it from mainland Europe.
Yes. Yeah,
so there was a real emergency stations.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And gosh, she had a task on her hands. When she took on the farm, it had been graded a C by WARAG standards. And so she took it on. It was derelict. There was a tree growing up through the lounge. There were rats everywhere. No running water, no electricity. She camped for the first sort of 6 months. And she got her men on side, got their families on side as well, improve their lives. But yeah, they had to make it a go of it or they would lose it. And I think that's quite astonishing, really. The precarity in farming was even more intense.
And she, Julia White, was quite forward-thinking. I mean, she was getting on the tractor. It was just really at the time when people were moving from horse-drawn ploughs to motorised vehicles.
Yes, that's right. And what I love about her is that she would give anything a go. Quite often, sort of if the men were holding back, she would step up and go, right, I'm going to do it, I'll drive the tractor. That's what she did. But she had an eye on the past. She had a deep respect for them and their knowledge. And for a long time, as is the case in a lot of farms, you sort of mingle old and new together, you mackle things and you have your traditions, but you also have that real state-of-the-art technology that you have to embrace as well. And she was there, she did it.
What brought you to this story, and not just Julia White, but the other women who were farming during the war years, the Second World War?
I suppose, you know, my dreams of being a farmer, sort of, I suppose, going back late 80s, when I was applying to agricultural college, I was met with, oh, well, is your father a farmer? I said, well, no, he's a fireman, actually. And have you married to a farmer? And quickly became clear that farming was not an option for me. And I thought, well, but where are the women in between them and me? Where are they? And why aren't there any? Growing up, I started farming on my bedroom carpet, like a lot of people did, with my really realistic Britain's Farm. And then I sort of graduated to horses, hanging around the stables. I'd never owned a horse, but always managed to have horses and ponies in our lives. But I wanted to be a farmer, and I was thinking, you know, aged, oh gosh, 16, 17, 18, I'm doing the same work, you know. I'm haymaking, you know, the small bales where you had to hump the hay onto the trailer, doing the hard, filthy, dirty work, the long hours. Why can't I do that in this field rather than the field with the horses in?
Yeah.
I got a really, really amazing break. I was invited out to Canada to work with horses initially on a dude ranch, which I suppose is a bit like a riding school. So you take people out on trips into the mountains, and we were in the Rocky Mountains. And then I had to come home, my visa ran out, and I worked and worked to save the money to go back. And this time round, I got a job with the cowboy on his ranch, and I worked as a cowgirl. My days were spent, again, on horseback. We'd be checking cattle, moving them, rounding them up, going to rodeos, brandings. It was just absolutely wonderful.
That really is the stuff of dreams.
Yeah, it really was, and I look back and, you know, the communities there that embraced me, really. I mean, I think there was an element of, I used to hear all the time, oh, you'll make a great country girl. And I used to think, I already am. I am a country girl. And I think reading between the lines, what they meant was, you know, when you're a little bit older, you'll make a great country wife. You'll make a great rancher's wife. So there was still that there.
When did you first sense, either in this country or elsewhere, that there were pathways that were clear for boys or young men that were not straightforward for you?
Oh, I think very early on. I remember summers working at the riding school, which was a little bit of a farm as well, and haymaking could not start until schools broke up and all the girls came to help with haymaking. There were a couple of boys, they drove the tractor, but we were there pulling up the bales onto the trailer, which was hard work because you're following a moving vehicle across the field, picking up bales, putting them on, piling them up. Dangerous work as well, but we were all in it together until payday, and then it became apparent that we were paid far less than the boys were. And to their credit, these lads who we went to school with stood up for us, and we had a bit of a standoff. We got a little bit more money.
But still not equal.
Still not equal, no.
I don't know why that really doesn't surprise me. Where we're walking on the footpath through a wood and the edge of fields, there is a lot of wooden sleeper boards to raise us up from the boggy ground. And it's got chicken wire over it, which means you've got a bit of grip. And it's very considerate, I would say. Ooh, yeah, look at these great orange berries.
They're wonderful, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think they're little tiny crab apples.
I think they are. And we've got a bit of beautiful, lush lichen on the tree. Christmas is well behind us now. But that looks like a tree that has been decorated, and yet nature's done that.
Yes, absolutely.
Walking along the country road, along the edge then of what was Miss Julia White's farm. How did you come across her diaries and start to be interested in her life?
Well, I first came across her diary because she published it. She self-published it when she was 85. It's very perfunctory, but at the time that's all I wanted. I just wanted to know that these women were out there farming. And then I forgot about it for, gosh, many a year, really. And then when I moved to this village of Inkpen, it was about 20 years ago, I've grown up in the area, I was haunted by her in the most extraordinary way. I didn't quite realise it at first, but little things would happen. I remember riding our old horse across the stubble field that was behind our then house, and she lost a shoe and went back to the field to find this, look for this lost shoe. And I found a shoe, but it wasn't my horse's. It was an enormous cart horse shoe. And it wasn't until a few years later when I got to researching the book that I realised this would have been one of Miss White's horses. So it would have been Dolly or Boxer or Silver. Yeah, it was just this incredible connection. And I thought, my goodness, nobody remembers this incredible woman and what she did.
And she was interesting, you know, you'd see her from Marlow because she's about 6 foot tall,
yes,
wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And came originally from the New Forest?
Yes.
Drove up here in her little caravan?
Yeah, yeah. So she decided, she met these two fabulous women, Marguerite Beaumont and Doris Mason, and they were farmers in Shelbourne, which is just over the fields there, actually. It's not very far away. And they also lived together as a romantic couple. And the village, they were the heart and soul of the village. They were much loved and totally accepted. And they met Julia White on a guide camp. And Julia sort of said, yeah, I would love to be a farmer. I just don't know how to go about it. And they talked about it. She went home, wrote a letter to them and said, is there a farmer? Do you know a farmer that would take me on as an apprentice? You know, I might get in the way, but I'll make up for it. And, you know, I really want to do this. And Doris said, well, come and be my apprentice. Come and live in the village and be our apprentice. We'll teach you how to farm. So she put her house up for rent, moved out of Southampton as the bombs were falling, bought herself a little caravan, and she hitched it to her little Rover car, drove it all the way here, parked it behind the barn in a little pony field, and began her farming apprenticeship. And a year later, she was confident enough to buy the farm here.
Gosh. Which they helped her with financially.
They helped her with financially,
yeah.
Yes. So they were confident enough.
Oh, wow.
That she
they
could
were
do
guardian
it.
Angels, weren't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love them. I love any stories about them. I just gobble up.
We can see shards of chalk and flint coming up from the land beneath. There's a lovely wide footpath to the left of this wheat field. And we're climbing upwards ahead, rising steeply into grey clouds, are the downs and the bare side of them. Because this is, you know, the landscape of my childhood, this type of down, I feel so drawn to it.
There's such a unique shape. I just don't think you really find it. It's such a smooth curve of this, you know, these hills that were once the sea. They do look like waves sort of rolling. And this is the biggest one, actually, for, I think it's the highest chalk hill in England. I have been told the world, but I've not checked that.
And yet they look climbable.
Yes.
So sometimes when, you know, I love the Lake District's beautiful. Obviously, I love Northumberland coastal. Lots of landscapes, great. But you might look at some hills thinking, I can't make it. Mm. This you look at and you think, oh, yeah, I can see there's a track going diagonally on the right there. That looks inviting.
Mm.
It makes you feel as if you want to climb it and go along the top.
It does indeed, yes.
Nicola's got her binoculars out and we've stopped because I can see a shape in the field. And I thought it must be a hare, but you can see it.
I thought it was a hare, but it's a red kite. And it's worming, so these mighty birds do eat a lot of worms. And we've got meadow pipits, skylarks as well, just going up.
And they'd be ground nesting.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have fed back, when you know there are nests on farming property, how receptive are the farmers to protecting those, making sure they don't run a machine right over them?
Do you know, I find that, because there's so much criticism of farmers and farming processes which do completely, literally actually run over birds. But if you get to talk to the farmers themselves, of course they want to protect these birds. I saw a stone curlew over the other side of the hill. Incredible birds. They're really quite rare now, though they're doing better. But we don't get many here because, again, of the farming practices. And I was out looking for hares and lapwings. And then into my view came this fantastic stone curlew. It was like a yacht sailing across. They've got these mad yellow goggle eyes and these strange knees. And delighted. But then over the hill came this massive tractor with its spraying arms out. And I was like Jenny Agutter in the railway. And I ran towards it, waving my arms. And the farmer pulled up. I said, look, something terrible's just about to happen. You're going to run over these birds. Like, there's two. I've seen two. They're going to nest. And he thought, well, that's great. Thank you for telling me. I'm going to program it into my computer, my tractor cab computer. It will deploy across all the fleet and we can avoid these birds.
That's clever.
It is wonderful.
So did he use what, three words for that?
Yes, he did.
Clever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which makes me actually remember that I haven't given the grid reference, just in case anyone wants to pick this up on a map. We met at the primary school.
Yes.
In Inkpen. We're on OS Explorer 158, which is Newbury and Hungerford, and on OS Explorer 131, which is Marlborough and Savernake Forest. It's sort of on the edge of both of those maps.
Yep.
So Inkpen is where we started, and the primary school was SU 368645. The rain that we saw chasing across the face of the downs is now
falling on us. And it's cold, it's a really cold rain on the skin. But given that just the other week I walked with Steve Boycott, who said he only enjoys a walk if it feels extreme, like it's got to hurt a bit. I've got a whole new attitude to this now. I'm like, yeah, bring it on. Rain on my face. Are we now swinging back towards where we started on the road here? So we'll go not far from where Julia White was farming. What happened to her?
Yeah, so she ran, in the end, a very successful farm. And age 55, she retired. She thought that the farming had come to a point where it needed an awful lot, another wave of investment. And she just didn't have the finances and the energy. She thought she'd done her bit. So she retired and had a wonderful send-off from the village. And it was all very emotional. I got very emotional reading about it, actually. And she bought herself a little house near Winchester with a field so she could still have guide camps. She took up painting and gardening, breeding dogs, and was very happy. So we're just coming past the start of this bridle path again. And this was where Julia drove the first combine harvester onto the fields. It was a big decision for her because she really appreciated her men and their wonderful skill at harvest time. Bert is a wonderful character, quite taciturn, and she had a way to get round him and ask him to do things for her. She had to sort of make this whole play of saying to Bert, she couldn't ask him direct, you know, if Bert, is it time to get the harvest in today? Do you think he'll say, well, it's not up to me, miss, you own the farm? So she had to sort of go at it sideways and say, Bert, if this was your farm, with all of your experience, what would you do today? And then he'd come back with an answer. But she got them all together one day and said, look, there's not enough of us to complete the harvest next year. Is it time? Do I invest in a combine harvester? And for people like Bert, it meant the end of things like rick building, which was the most incredible skill to build these little thatched houses out of straw with all the corn inside that you would then put through a threshing machine on a winter's day. All that would come to an end. So it was a big weight of responsibility. But, you know, she appealed to the men and they came back to her. Bert became the new... He was king of the harvest and he was now king of the combine harvester. But he didn't drive it first. She had to drive it first. He wasn't going to drive it first and put it in a ditch. She had to do that. But that's how they went on.
We've walked into the graveyard that surrounds Inkpen Church, which is a very small flint church with a steep peaked roof. Tell me why we've come into the churchyard, because this connects with what happened to Julia White.
Yes, so we've come to see Julia. I had to find her will because I needed copyright to reproduce her diaries or rewrite them. And when I got her will, because I just assumed that she'd been buried in Winchester, I found that she had written in the desire to come back to Inkpen. So her ashes are interred in the churchyard here.
How long did it take you to find her?
Well, it took a long time, actually, because we came out. Now, there is a plan of all the gravestones with all the names of where people are buried. We located her on the map, came out here, and she wasn't there. There was just grass. So I turned round, and my husband was with me, and we had the dog with us as well. And I turned round, and my husband is on his knees, knocking on the ground to see if he could hear any hollowness. And I went to join him. So there we were, both on our hands and knees, in the middle of the churchyard, at dusk, the moon rising behind us. And I pushed my fingers through the turf, and I felt this stone.
Oh my God.
And we started pulling at the turf, and up it came, and the first thing we saw was the words, farmed the manor farm.
And there it and is. Oh, my gosh. So it says Julia Maud White. Because she's born in 1900. She didn't die until 1989.
No, amazing. And I've got one other thing to show you.
Go on. Oh, exciting.
So it's the most beautiful, simple horse-drawn plough. So it's got two red-painted wheels at the front, a land wheel and a furrow wheel, and then the chains at the front where you would attach your horses to, and then it's got your coulter and your mould board, which will cut through the soil and turn it over. And the rest of the plough is painted in its traditional blue, so it's a blue and red plough.
And there's a plaque with a picture of a ploughman and his big shire horse saying this plough is a tribute to all who over the years have worked the land in the parish of Inkpen.
And the surprise is, this is Julia White's plough. This is the plough that she learnt to plough with. I just think it's wonderful. Wow. And when I realised that, I just stood there and held the handles and just, I was away. Yes, like you're doing now.
But I had to. Has it been enough for you to tell her story? Or is there still that feeling of unresolved ambition in you that you want to farm yourself?
I think it's settled into a new path for me. I don't think I'll get to farm now. But for me, to be that farmer of the imagination, to be out on the land, walking particularly, learning the stories, telling the stories, supporting those good farmers, I think that's where my path lies now. And I'm quite comfortable with that. I think there are so many more stories to tell and to honour these people from the past, but also tell about their relevance now. And what I've loved doing in the book as well is going back to ask Julia White's ghost, as it were, you know, what could you have done differently? What would you have wanted? And to take that forward.
Mm. Yeah. And to allow those ghosts of the farm to still have a voice.
Yes, yeah.
And they do have a voice.
They do.
Thank you, Nicola. What a great walk. And I feel very connected to those, the stories of those that have been here before us, and particularly Julia White.
Oh, thank you, Claire. It's been a pleasure.
Ramblings with Nicola Chester was presented by Claire Balding and produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios production for BBC Radio 4. Where, in just a moment, octopuses, flooding and this year's Sustainable Foods Conference all feature in Farming Today this week, although, as far as I know, the three topics aren't connected. Then at 7 o'clock, the Saturday edition of Today is presented by Leila Nathu and Simon Jack. Looking a bit further ahead this afternoon, you can hear the mayor of Kyiv, the former heavyweight boxer Vitaly Klitschko, talking to Nick Robinson on political thinking. He'll be discussing the challenges of running a city of 3 million people during wartime. Political thinking is at 5:30.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Now, Farming Today this week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week, how to make farming better for the environment and the bottom line.
I think there is an urgent need in this country to think differently about the way in which we pay farmers to produce the benefits that we want them to.
We'll hear from farming communities flooded again and calling for more help.
We all know the weather patterns are changing. Why isn't government investing in infrastructure to cope with this?
More on that later. Now, you may remember we reported last May about the large number of octopuses appearing in coastal waters in the southwest of England. We heard from crab fisherman Brian Tapper in Plymouth.
The octopus are ruining us. There's just nothing there. The octopus are coming in the little side hatch in the entrance here, and it's like McDonald's for them. They're just sitting in there. When they're full, they'll go along a whole string of pots. They'll go through 50 pots, and all you'll get in here is empty shells, little small lobsters, little small crabs, even scallops. And then once they've finished, off they go.
Brian Tapper there. Well, now the University of Plymouth has published a report bringing together evidence from scientists, fishermen and citizen scientists to reveal more about what's known as the octopus bloom and what it can tell us about the changing marine environment and the consequences for sea life. Anna Hill spoke to research analyst and associate professor Bryce Stewart, who led the research.
I mean, it really was quite extraordinary. Nothing like this has been seen in UK waters for at least 75 years. And there's indications that this might be the biggest bloom of this species of common octopus ever. It's still going on now. In fact, you know, even in November and December, fishermen were still catching a lot of them. Over the previous sort of 6 or 7 years, the entire fleet would land between 20 and 30 tons of the common octopus a year. And last year they landed close to 2,000 tonnes, so it's almost 65 times higher than the recent average.
Why did it happen? Do we know now?
There does seem to be a very strong link with warmer sea temperatures, which is not surprising given this is a species that normally lives in southern Europe and northern Africa, but it has always been here just at low levels. What we did is we looked at both the environmental conditions around this recent bloom, but also when it's happened in the past. So one in 1950, one in the 1930s, and then another one at the turn of last century. And even though overall seas were cooler back then, those years, both the year before the bloom and also when the bloom happened, were much warmer than average. That helps with breeding of the octopus, but it also, if they arrive, say, as they did on our shores, probably as small larvae out of the plankton, then in warmer conditions, they're going to grow and sort of eat much faster as well. And that seems to be what we've been seeing.
How much did they affect the fishermen's catches? And are they still doing that?
Yeah, they absolutely seem to have had a big effect on the catches, particularly for shell fishermen. So the species that have declined the most in terms of the commercial fishery for them are brown crabs and scallops, which are both, the landings last year in the southwest have dropped by about over 50%, and lobsters by about 30%. So they're pretty dramatic reductions. And the scallops is particularly interesting in a way, because scallops wouldn't normally go into crab and lobster pots unless there's this new method using lights to lure them in, but these weren't pots with lights in them. So the only explanation is that the octopus were actually collecting scallops and putting them in crab pots as a larder to go back to later on. And so we think that they see these crab pots as like little dens, basically. You also saw things like rocks and old shells and all sorts of weird stuff. So, yeah, pretty extraordinary behaviour.
What can fishermen do? Could they prevent them from getting into their pots or maybe catch them and sell them?
Octopus are incredibly clever. They have not only brains in their heads, but in their tentacles and in their eyes. They're an extraordinary species and they can learn things as well. So it'd be very, very difficult to stop them getting into the pots. But I think going forward, if this is a species that's here to stay, then it will support a commercial fishery. And for those fishermen, that will become a necessity. You know, they'll have to diversify. Hopefully we will still have a certain level of crabs and lobsters and scallops, but also we're likely to have octopus. It's going to be difficult. There's a lot of changes. You know, you fish for octopus in a different way. You have to find different markets for them, mostly overseas. British people don't really like to eat them very much. So it's certainly an uncertain future for the fishing industry, and there's quite a few challenges ahead.
Bryce Stewart from the University of Plymouth. At the end of a rough week, let's talk about the weather. It has dominated life for many, from storms and flooding in southwest England to snow and rain in parts of Scotland, flooding in Northern Ireland and strong winds and rain across Wales. Much of this has been due to Storm Chandra. But this month, we've also had two other named storms and above average rainfall. BBC Weather says some areas have had twice their average for this time of year. The wettest areas, like Aberdeenshire, have had triple. Bruce Mackey is an organic dairy farmer in Aberdeenshire. He's also been contending with snow.
Local farmers with snow ploughs keeping the road open. That's been a fantastic effort. And also a great effort by our tanker drivers to get through when they could get through. One of the big challenges as a dairy producer is getting our milk collected in the snow. We missed two collections, so we lost two tanks of milk. Probably about 15,000 litres that we had to pour away. So frustrating to have to do it anyway, having spent all the time and effort and things to get the cows milked and fed and everything, to just have to pour it down the drain.
Bruce Mackey there. Well, on the Somerset Levels, a major incident was declared after Storm Chandra, and they're facing more rain this weekend. Arable and beef farmer James Winslade farms on the levels. His land was underwater for 3 months during the floods of 2014. And when we spoke earlier this week, he told me 95% of his land was back underwater.
It's like an inland sea. We're stood looking at water wherever you are, and none of it you'd want to drink. The farm is on an island. We are higher than the roads around us. The water is rising a centimetre an hour at the moment. They are getting the pumps. Some pumps are running now at long last. These are all the auxiliary pumps, the extra pumps that they bring in. In the end, the Environment Agency relented, brought the pumps in early. Thank goodness they did, because if we would be in a lot different situation. We all know the weather patterns are changing. They're predicting heavier, wetter winters. Why isn't the infrastructure, why isn't government investing in across the whole country in infrastructure to cope with this?
James Winslade in the Somerset Levels. The Environment Agency told us powerful pumps were sent to support key pumping stations across the Somerset Levels much earlier than agreed flooding trigger points. They are already operating and reducing water levels ahead of further forecast rain, with further equipment en route from national stockpiles. We deliver many £1 million worth of flood defence work across Somerset annually, including on the River Parrot. Well, the state of infrastructure is becoming a bit of a theme in rural areas. In Devon, the leader of the Liberal Democrat-run County Council has called on the government for urgent financial support because of the impact of this month's storms, particularly on roads and railways, saying more frequent rough weather highlights the need for more investment. James Dyke, Associate Professor of Earth Systems Science at Exeter University, says the country has to do more to adapt to climate change.
A consistent message from the Climate Change Committee is that the UK has not been keeping up. It needs to invest an awful lot more resources, effort and money in protecting communities, rural communities, coastal communities and urban communities from climate change.
So when we look at, for instance, the rail line at Dawlish or roads across Devon, which have been closed because of flooding, is that what they're talking about there?
Absolutely. The section of the rail line that we lost in the last storm, just down the road from where I live in Exeter, they've only recently finished rebuilding that and doing the flood protection works from the 2014 storm. So in the not too distant future, they're going to have to do even more work, because in some respects, it's trying to keep up with an escalator or a treadmill that's running faster and faster. Now, for some portions of the country, there will be political will and there will be sufficient support for us to continue that work. For other places, not so much. So already there are decisions about which bits of the coast and maybe which bits of floodplain are we going to protect and which are we going to have to retreat away from.
We've just heard from James Winslade in Somerset on the levels. It's flooded again. But there is a cost-benefit analysis here. If farmland takes the hit, then it's not worth spending loads of money to defend it fundamentally.
Yeah, so farmland has always had an important role to play in flood defence, which is essentially allow waters that have breached rivers to occupy that land. So it's certainly been some disastrous planning decisions about situating homes and houses on floodplains. But that does mean that if we're expecting farmers to take up the slack of flood protection schemes, then they need to be, in some respects, reimbursed, because obviously it's a direct impact on their livelihoods.
What sort of bill are we looking at then in the UK if we start trying to adapt infrastructure?
We can adapt to a certain amount, but if we don't also see at the same time the now quite rapid phase out of the burning of coal, oil and gas, then we are in some respects going to be wasting our money, because whilst we will be able to deploy infrastructure and engineering for higher and higher seawalls at quite significant costs, so we're probably talking in the realms of tens of billions of pounds, eventually those things will be overtopped by rising sea levels. So we have to make some difficult decisions about how we're going to allocate resources to defend the places, the towns, the country, the farmland that we think is most important, We're also going to have to accelerate the phase out of fossil fuels and play our part in the international efforts to do that. Because if that doesn't happen, then I'm afraid the prospects for the British Isles, for the United Kingdom, is going to be very, very bleak.
James Dyke from Exeter University. Well, earlier this week, I went to an event all about making the whole food system more sustainable. Food manufacturers, retailers, policymakers and some farmers were there discussing what needs to change. I'm just making my way up the stairs and ahead of me is a beautiful stained glass sign and it says Royal Agricultural Hall. Well, the sign and indeed the hall date back to the 1860s. This place is now the Business Design Centre here in Islington in North London. And today it is playing host to Sustainable Foods 2026.
I'm going to be bringing you the fifth annual Sustainable Foods Conference here at the Business Design Centre in London.
As I say, it does cover the whole food chain. For obvious reasons, we're just going to concentrate on the farming end of all that. So let's start with Henry Dimbleby. He's speaking here. He's the author of the National Food Strategy produced for the last government, co-founder of Leon, the fast food restaurant chain, and co-founder of Bramble Partners, an investment firm which he says will back businesses that will change the food system for the better.
For farming, it's fascinating. I'm going to start where you wouldn't expect me to. So on appetite-suppressing drugs. So I think for farmers, if you're in the commodities game, people eating less is a problem. And then on the sustainability and the climate side, I think there is an urgent need in this country to think differently about the way in which we pay farmers to produce the benefits that we want them to. So sustainable food, secure food, good soil. And we have the government, we have bits and pieces of green finance, so water companies paying people not to put nitrogen into rivers. But fundamentally, I think we need to move to a mass balance approach, similar to what we have in fair trade, where there is a premium for farming in a certain way. We need farmers to shift much more quickly towards regenerative. And the way to do that is to create a premium working with some of the big companies here that gets paid to people who are making commodities.
There's one sort of basic problem with that, which is define regenerative. What you might mean by regenerative and what somebody else at this conference might mean can be two very different things.
100%. And the question is, who does that? At the moment, you have this crazy system where you've got brands, marks, which I think are important. So Soil Association have a brand. There are some people who get the premium through the customer, but most people do not have the headspace to think about that. And so more broadly, regenerative farming, what do you have? You have things the government will pay you to do, which change, uncertain, move from scheme to scheme.
And are different in the different parts of the UK, because yes. Here in England we have ELMS, the Sustainable Farming Incentive, which is closed at the moment to new applications, will open for small farms, we don't know what that means yet, in June.
Yes, so then you've got in the commodities market the Nestle's, the Ferrero's, those kind of people who all have their own standards, their own tick sheets. And so the question is, who is it that makes these rules? And I think you need to have farmers cooperatising and then pre-competitive efforts from companies to define standards on which there's a premium. How do the farmers make sure that they get enough money for that? That has to be about cooperatisation. You know, you cannot negotiate with a huge multinational unless you are doing it in some way in a cooperative fashion.
Henry Dimbleby there. Well, the Farming Minister, Angela Eagle, is also at this event. She agrees that our food system isn't currently working for everyone and change is needed. I asked her where farming fits in.
Well, what needs to change in farming, firstly, is that we need to farm more sustainably in an eco-friendly way so that we can make the best use of our resources. We want to make farming as profitable as possible, which is why we've got the Baroness Batters report, and we'll be making some announcements about how we're going to implement that. We've got the farming roadmap, which will set more of a direction that farmers can perceive. And so ideally what we want is a farming system which produces lots of fresh food in a sustainable way, which we can get to every part of our society. So I think that they've got a huge role to play in trying to make sure that we change our food system for the better.
In England, though, the government schemes that we have when they're up and running are public money for public goods. They're not about food production, are they?
Well, they are about farming in an environmentally friendly way. And I actually think that given climate change and the resilience issues, we are more likely to be able to farm in that way if we make our farming more sustainable. So that's pushing the whole system, not just to think about bulk production, but to think about farming in a nature-friendly way that will preserve the fertility of our soils, that will make it less likely that we have catastrophic flooding if we get better management of our river systems. So it's trying to shift to something that's far more sustainable.
There's a lot of talk at this event about regenerative farming.
Yeah.
Some farmers and equally some consumers see that as a bit of a catch-all, even a greenwashing term, because there isn't really one definition of what it actually is. Where does it fit into the government's thinking?
We have to make certain that we farm in a way that fits in with the environment rather than destroys it. And the more that we learn about how that is, the more we're going to be pushing the system with our farming monies to execute that change. I don't want to get into a big row about the definition of regenerative farming, but I'm going to say something like this. We need to farm in a more holistic way that means that we can preserve for future use the fertility of the land. And so that means that some of our older ways of doing things aren't going to work. We need to, for example, bear down on water pollution that comes from the beef sector and the dairy sector. And there are ways we know we can do that, and we want to help the sector shift to doing that in a more effective way.
But some of those changes, as farmers here will point out, add cost. So who's going to pay for that?
Well, I think that if you've got a whole systems transformation like this, we've got to have more debates about this so people understand the connection between farming and farming profitably and affordable, highly nutritious food. We've got a system at the moment that doesn't deliver those potentials to some of our poorest areas. So having access to locally grown vegetables, for example, or fruit, might be a good way of dealing with some of that. And we're going to be doing some work, see if we can put those two things together, which is why the Batters Review, one of the sectors that we've announced we want to take a particular look at to begin with, is horticulture.
The Farming Minister, Angela Eagle. As you can probably tell by the noise, it's coffee break time. I'm just in the back of the queue. Cup of tea and hopefully a biscuit. A lot of people here are from the sustainability end of big companies. A few farmers dotted around, and I've just bumped into Phil Hambling from ABP.
We're a fresh meat processing company, so we're one of the largest beef and lamb processors in the UK. Principally, our core business is around providing own brand products to UK retailers.
In that context, how important is sustainability?
It's probably number one on the agenda when we're talking to customers. They're seriously interested in also being a connected partner in helping driving sustainability, particularly at farm level. And what we're here to talk about today is the work that we've done through PRISM, our programme for improving the sustainability of red meats, and the 350 farmers that have been on us in that journey.
What sorts of changes have those farmers made to try and make red meat more sustainable? Because there are going to be people who are just laughing at this point and saying, look, it's fundamentally unsustainable. It's not really that good for us in large quantities. We need to be moving away.
Clearly, this is a much more complicated picture than some of those reductionist arguments would play for. We're in our second round of assessments right now, working in partnership with Harper Adams. And some farmers have made some significant changes, changing their breeding patterns, switching up their agronomy, much more use of multi-species swards, reducing fertiliser use. And for the farmers that have changed, they've made a significant reduction in their emissions as well, somewhere in the order of 2 or 3 kilos of CO2 equivalent per kilo of beef.
What about the price in all this? Will your customers pay more?
Well, what we've seen is perhaps a maturity within a good number of brands actually willing to invest. But what they understandably want is also to be able to capture that benefit for the customer. They want return on that investment in sustainability terms. So now we have seen very, very significant investments from a number of different brands in this space, and we're happy to be partners to some of those.
When it comes to consumers, there's a lot of talk, particularly here, about things like regenerative farming, about sustainability. How much of that is actually meaningful to a shopper in the sense that they'll be happy to pay a bit more for it?
I think in general terms, the average consumer's understanding about sustainability is very low. But to be fair, I rely on aeroplane manufacturers to do a good job every time I get on an aeroplane. And I think a lot of consumers want to rely on those brands and the food industry to do the right thing for them. To be able to navigate all that complexity on a label is very, very challenging. And explaining why doing a good job deserves a premium is also very difficult for consumers. Look, there's always going to be room for premiumization, but if something premium becomes mainstream, there's no more premium. And I think there's something about how we help farmers, help them on the journey of sustainability, help improve their farm resilience, and hopefully helping secure the economic resilience at the same time.
I'm standing on the balcony now, overlooking people mingling and networking in the break. It's amazing just how many people are at this event and who comes. We've got CEOs from Tesco and from Morrisons, the CEO from Müller, Managing Director of Arla, the President of Danone, and standing next to me, Andy Cato from Groove Armada, who's also co-founder of Wild Farmed and a farmer. Now, Wild Farmed pays farmers a premium for regenerative farming, and then it sells branded products, but it also sells ingredients to other food producers. So what is regenerative farming? Because one of the criticisms of it, which we've heard today, is it can mean anything.
Well, I suppose at its most basic, it's farming that leaves the ecosystem better than it finds it. But to build awareness and build agency amongst our customers from the beginning, we wanted to be very clear about what we meant by that. And so the first iteration of that was our Wild Farm standards. Ultimately, we want to say to our customers, what's happened to nature, what's happened to water, what's happened to carbon, and of course, what's happened to farmer outcomes, because if we haven't got good farmer outcomes, there's nothing else to talk about.
So it's sustainable in that it's good for the environment, good for biodiversity and so on, but it has to be financially sustainable, which is where the premium comes in.
We've assigned value to nature on non-food producing land. What we've singularly failed to do is value nature in food producing systems. And our whole mission is to bring nature and food production together. And a lot of the last 6 years has been developing a nature metric that's affordable and scalable for arable systems. Because ultimately farmers can only respond to economic incentives. They're right up against it financially speaking. So if we don't create economic incentives for nature, for water quality, for food quality, then how can farmers possibly deliver them?
And who's paying for this? Is it the consumer ultimately who's choosing to spend a bit more on a Wild Farmed loaf than a different loaf?
I think, well, at the moment our customers pay a little bit more. Ultimately, I think as a society we have to redefine what we value. So the Treasury needs to move beyond language of subsidy and recognise that actually supporting farmers to regenerate land and nature, build resilience, is probably the best return on investment that any government can make. In the meantime, we have to find solutions ourselves. And so one of the things that we've done, which I think is unique in grain markets at least, is to build a segregated supply chain so we can measure the nature, the water, the carbon, the grain quality impacts on the field level. We can then keep that supply chain segregated, and that allows us to get everyone along that supply chain to participate. And we have to collaborate on this. We can't put all this on farmers.
Andy Cato. And you can hear more about a sustainable food system on next week's food programme, when Dan Saladino will ask retailers, politicians, food companies and farmers how they see the future of food, health, sustainability and resilience. That's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Beatrice Fenton. And Farming Today This Week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
And now with the weather forecast, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Charles. Good morning. We've got quite a bit of showery rain in the forecast through the course of the weekend, but it is showery in nature, so not the heavy, persistent rain that some of us have seen over the past week or so, and there'll be some brighter spells around today too. In fact, let's start with where we'll see some of the drier weather, so southeast England through the East Midlands and eastern England, as well as the northwest of Scotland. All these areas are set to stay generally dry. There might be just one or two passing showers moving through pretty quickly, but some blue skies, some sunshine, cloud gradually increasing towards the southeast, I think, during the afternoon. Temperatures across the northwest of Scotland, 7 or 8 degrees, down towards eastern and southeast England, up to about 9 or 10. But we've got more cloud and rain further north and west. So if you're across the southwest of England, the West Midlands, Wales, Northern England, Northern Ireland, as well as southwest Scotland, well, here we've got a lot of cloud and showery rain through the morning. It will dry up for some, particularly for Northern Ireland, I think, as we head into the afternoon. But elsewhere, you're going to keep the on and off outbreaks of rain. The breeze will pick up as well, and temperatures will range between about 7 to 10 degrees. Eastern and northeastern Scotland, lastly. And today we've still got a fairly cool southeasterly wind, and that's going to be driving in more rain at low levels, some snow over the higher ground, snowfall totals really mounting up for the Grampians, for instance, and temperatures just 4 degrees for the Northern Isles, 5 or 6 towards mainland parts of eastern Scotland. Now through tonight then, a lot of cloud generally. Showery rain drifts its way northwards and eastwards across all areas through the night. More showers moving in from the southwest by the end of the night. So it's damp, reasonably mild, around 2 to 5 degrees. Could be just a touch of frost for a few prone spots. But into tomorrow then, your Sunday starts off on that fairly cloudy, grey and damp note. So light showery rain for many of us. It will be clearing up from the west though. Some sunshine returns to Northern Ireland, Wales and the southwest of England tomorrow. It stays cool at 6 to 10 degrees.
Sarah Keith-Lucas. Next this morning, it's Today with Leila Nathu and Simon Jack. First though, it's Murder on Radio 4.
A homicide is like a nuclear bomb going off.
Drama. Inspired by the work of a real-life forensic psychiatrist.
If someone has taken another person's life, whatever their motive, their old life disappears with it.
Set in the world of secure psychiatric units.
This woman doesn't steal. She doesn't lie, she doesn't cheat, and she certainly doesn't murder her own mother.
Wasn't an accident.
The new series of This Thing of Darkness on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I could have died just now.
Starting this Tuesday at 2:15.
On FM, on digital and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 31st of January. This is Today with Leila Nathu and Simon Jack.
The headlines this morning. Messages sent by the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein months after he'd been released from prison suggest he invited Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to meet a Russian woman in 2010. The claim is among a cache of more than 3 million files released by the US Justice Department on Jeffrey Epstein. They also contain allegations against Bill Gates, Donald Trump and Lord Mandelson. All deny wrongdoing. And the Hollywood actress Catherine O'Hara, star of the Home Alone films, has died.
Our focus on social media, phones and screen time on Friday's programme seems to have struck a chord. Many of you got in touch wanting to talk about the impact of screens on very young children, the under fives. Research from Ofcom shows 37% of the parents of 3 to 5-year-olds say their child regularly uses at least one app or site. But it wasn't all bad news, with one mum, Jo, urging adults not to throw all the social media out with the bathwater.
Of course, you don't put your child in front of a screen all day and walk away. I think just saying screen time or no screen time, there's a lot of nuances within it, and we really have to look at it.
Have you tried pickle juice? It worked wonders for Carlos Alcaraz during his Australian Open semi-final. Is it the secret ingredient we've all been waiting for? Leila and I will put it to the test a little later in the programme to see if it can get us through to 9 o'clock.
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday Sport, and we're sticking with Carlos Alcaraz. He came through a gripping five-set match in the semi-finals, as did Novak Djokovic, to set up a final with history on the line, whichever way it goes. And the women's final between Arina Sabalenka and Elena Rybakina gets underway in Melbourne at 8:30 this morning.
Thank you, Simon. The BBC News this morning is read by Charles Carroll.
Email exchanges from 2010 suggest the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein set up a dinner for Andrew Mountbatten Windsor with a woman the financier described as Russian and beautiful. The messages are among more than 3 million pages of documents released by the US Department of Justice, together with thousands of images. It said they formed the final tranche of the files on Epstein, which it was ordered to make public. He had close links with a series of high-profile figures, including Donald Trump, and killed himself while awaiting trial in 2019. Our first report on the files, by our correspondent Chichi Azundu, examines the new claims made about the former Prince Andrew and his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson.
There are a few emails in which Epstein indicates his intentions to be at royal residences, including Royal Lodge, and there appears to be an invite from the former prince for Epstein to visit Buckingham Palace. Some of these exchanges are in 2010, months after Epstein's release from prison for procuring a child for prostitution. In a chain of emails between Epstein and an account titled The Duke, Epstein says he wants to introduce the Duke to what he describes as a 26-year-old, beautiful, clever and trustworthy Russian woman because he thinks he might enjoy having dinner with her. The emails discuss the arrangements and the Duke signs his response with an A and an email signature which reads HRH, Duke of York, KG. Separately, in 2009, there are messages which appear to be between Epstein and Sarah Ferguson, where she says, I am landing in Palm Beach in a couple of hours. Is there any chance on my quick layover that I can get to have a quick cup of tea? The financier was still under house arrest when that email was sent. One document is a formal request for assistance in 2020 from US authorities asking to interview the former prince. Although he wasn't the target of the inquiry, officials say they believe he may have been a witness to or a participant in events relevant to their investigation. The BBC has not been able to verify the authorship of the emails disclosed by the US Department of Justice, and BBC News has asked both Mr. Mountbatten Windsor and Ms. Ferguson for comment. But so far, neither has responded. Both have previously, though, strenuously denied all allegations of any wrongdoing connected to Epstein.
President Trump is mentioned hundreds of times in the documents. The US Justice Department insisted allegations of wrongdoing by him were false. There are also claims of a sexual nature against the Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, which he has furiously rejected. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports from Washington.
The claims about Bill Gates are from emails that appear to have been drafted by Epstein. They suggest the Microsoft co-founder caught a sexually transmitted disease from Russian girls and that he tried to hide it from his then-wife, Melinda. A spokesperson for Mr. Gates said the allegations were absolutely absurd and completely false. The claims against Donald Trump, some of sexual abuse, come from a list compiled by the FBI last year based on calls to a national tip line. Many appear to be sourced on unverified information and were made without supporting evidence. The Justice Department said they were unfounded and false. Mr. Trump has consistently denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. Many of the documents are heavily redacted, with some pages completely blacked out. There are calls from both Democrats and Republicans for full transparency, in line with the law that forced the Justice Department to release the files. But the Deputy Attorney General, Todd Blanche, said the latest release marked the end of the process, even though he acknowledged it would not satisfy the need for more information. In a joint statement, Epstein survivors said they would not stop until the truth was fully revealed.
Further evidence of the relationship between Britain's former US ambassador, Lord Mandelson, and Epstein has emerged in the documents. These include emails from the Labour peer requesting to stay at Epstein's New York apartment in 2009 when he was business secretary and when Epstein was serving a prison sentence in Florida. Lord Mandelson told the BBC he was never culpable nor complicit in Epstein's crimes. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
Lord Mandelson was sacked as Washington ambassador last year when Downing Street said that emails dating from 2008 showed a greater depth to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein than had been known at the time of his appointment. Before he was made ambassador, it had previously been reported that Lord Mandelson had requested to stay at Mr. Epstein's New York apartment. Now the US Department of Justice has released messages from 2009 between the two men. Epstein suggested there might be issues with the press and mentioned a different apartment, but Lord Mandelson, who was a senior Labour cabinet minister, said he was on a private visit and the facilities were better at Epstein's home. It's understood in the end he didn't stay at any of Epstein's properties at the time. And newly released emails also show Lord Mandelson's then partner and now husband requesting funds from Epstein for an osteopathy course after the financier's release from prison later in 2009. £10,000 was sent. Emails from Epstein to his accountant in 2010 suggest further payments could also have been made. Lord Mandelson said he was wrong to believe Epstein following his conviction and has apologised to the women and girls who suffered for continuing his association with the disgraced financier.
In other news this morning, a partial shutdown of the US government has come into effect, even though the Senate passed a compromise deal yesterday. The shutdown will continue until Monday, when the House of Representatives will meet to approve the funding. The Prime Minister will meet his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo later, after completing a three-day visit to China. Sir Keir Starmer is meeting Sanae Takeuchi for dinner. Our political editor, Chris Mason, is travelling with Sir Keir and sent this report.
After 24 hours in Shanghai and another blitz of glad-handing and smiles, the Prime Minister's team hope their 3 days in China can start to reboot a sense here of British enthusiasm for engagement with the country, as critics, not least the Conservatives, question the wisdom of making the trip at all. Sir Keir Starmer is now en route to Japan for a stop of just a few hours, where he's popping in for dinner with the country's first female leader, Sanae Takeuchi. Downing Street are taking advantage of Sir Keir already being here in Asia to call in on an ally who they describe as the UK's largest inward investor outside of Europe.
The UK's first train powered only by batteries is to begin carrying passengers today. It'll begin services on a 2.5 mile line in Greenford in West London, using a fast charging system to top up its batteries between journeys. And Hollywood has been remembering the Emmy Award-winning actress Catherine O'Hara, who has died aged 71. She starred in the 1990 film Home Alone and was also known for her roles in Beetlejuice and Schitt's Creek. The director, Ron Howard, described her as a wonderful person, artist and collaborator. Our arts correspondent, David Sillitoe, looks back at her life.
I have a terrible feeling.
About what?
That we didn't do something.
It was more than 30 years ago that Catherine O'Hara played Kate McAllister, the mother on the plane realising she'd left something behind.
Kevin!
Home Alone was just one of a string of hit movies in the 80s and 90s for this Canadian actor who'd come up through the comedy circuit. And then in her 60s saw her career take off again with comedies such as Schitt's Creek. Among those paying tribute, Kevin, Macaulay Culkin, who wrote, "I thought we had time. We had so much more to say."
David Sillitoe.
Charles, many thanks. Well, let's start with a quick look at today's papers and all of the range of allegations from the latest release of the files relating to Jeffrey Epstein, published by the US Justice Department, are across the front pages today. The Daily Mail and Times are highlighting Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's apparent invitation to the disgraced financier to visit Buckingham Palace after Jeffrey Epstein had been convicted. The Daily Telegraph and The Sun are detailing the claim that the sex offender offered to set up a meeting between the former prince and a 26-year-old Russian woman. The Guardian, for their part, goes on connections between Jeffrey Epstein and Lord Mandelson's husband, saying that Jeffrey Epstein sent money to him. While the Daily Star hones in on the lurid claims concerning the tech billionaire Bill Gates, which he has strongly denied. The Mirror, meanwhile, leads with claims relating to Trump that Donald Trump, the Department for Justice, has described as unfounded and false.
We'll get the view from the US and the UK on some of that in a few moments. The FT weekend focuses on Donald Trump's choice to take over as the chair of the Federal Reserve, probably the most powerful non-elective representative in the world. Kevin Warsh is his pick, and this person has buoyed confidence in the dollar. The paper says he's well regarded on Wall Street, and his nomination will ease worries about the president's relentless campaign to force the Fed to lower borrowing rates. We'll get the views of Mohamed El-Erian and the eminent economist on that pick a little later in the programme.
And the much-hyped documentary about Melania Trump, produced by Melania Trump, was shown to reviewers before its release. So this morning's papers give critics their first chance to talk about the film itself. More outfit changes than The Devil Wears Prada, but we're no nearer unravelling the mystery that is Melania Trump. That is the view off the Mail today. The movie isn't so bad, it's good, it's just boring, concludes The Times. And Telegraph describes it as Melania's North Korean-style propaganda, served ice cool with a dash of Ralph Lauren. 2 hours of Melania feels like pure endless hell is how The Guardian ends its
will you be watching?
Rather scathing zero-star review.
I lied to protect my mates, is the Daily Express's headline, as it says. England's white ball cricket captain Harry Brook has admitted he wasn't alone during an altercation with a nightclub bouncer in New Zealand last November. The Telegraph says Jacob Bethel and Josh Tung could also now be under investigation by the cricket regulator. The Times says the development raises questions over whether Brook can remain captain.
Right, well, let us return to those millions of new files relating to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein published by the US Justice Department last night. Todd Blanche, the US Deputy Attorney General, said the batch of documents marked the end of the Trump administration's planned releases under a law which said they must all be made public. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes has been looking at the latest documents, and I spoke to him shortly before we came on air.
This is a vast collection of documents, images and video, many with redactions, in some cases entire pages blacked out. And there are many reasons for that, of course, the main one being to protect the identities of victims. Although we have spoken to a lawyer, Gloria Allred, in Los Angeles, who represents a number of the Epstein survivors, and in fact the survivors have released their own statement as well, saying that they are furious that, in their opinion, some of their identities have been released in these documents. So they insist that they will not give up their campaign. They are angry that in its totality, only about 50% of these files have been released, and they believe there is so much more information to be made public.
A few standout claims relating to names that have been associated with Jeffrey Epstein in the past.
Well, yes, Bill Gates claims about Bill Gates in these emails that appear to have been drafted by Jeffrey Epstein. They suggest that the Microsoft co-founder caught a sexually transmitted disease from Russian girls and that he tried to hide it from his then wife, Melinda. And a spokesman for Mr. Gates has said that the claims are absolutely absurd and false.
Let's turn to President Trump, because his name is mentioned hundreds of times in these newly released documents, at least from what we can see so far. What's your assessment of how damaging his name being in these files could be for him?
As long as this story continues to be in the headlines, it is potentially damaging for Donald Trump. You're right, there are hundreds of references in one document, a number of allegations about him of a sexual nature that come from an FBI tip line, which investigators at the time deemed not to be credible. Donald Trump has consistently denied any wrongdoing in relation to Jeffrey Epstein. He has not been accused of any crimes. Nevertheless, this is an election year. He wants to distract attention away from this story as soon as possible, but it just isn't going away.
Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent. Thank you.
Well, let's pick up on that, and it's obviously dominating the UK front pages as well. Let's pick up with Simon Jones, who's here with us in the studio. And the UK angle to this, what stood out for you?
Well, newspaper headlines today tell the story. One of them reads, Epstein fixed Russian girl for Andrew. And another says, Andrew invited paedophile to Paris. Now, there are several messages in these documents from August 2010 between Epstein and an email address named The Duke. Now, the email signature appears to read, HRH, the Duke of York, KG, which stands for Knight of the Garter. And this was after Epstein had been released from prison after being convicted of soliciting sex from a 14-year-old girl in Florida. Now, Epstein, in one of the emails, writes, I have a friend who I think you might enjoy having dinner with. In response, the account labelled The Duke replies, of course, I'm in Geneva until the morning of the 22nd, but would be delighted to see her. Please give her my contact details to get in touch. Epstein later says, she's 26, Russian, clever, beautiful, trustworthy, and yes, she has your email. The email account labelled The Duke then replies, that was quick. How are you? Good to be free. And other emails suggest Andrew invited Epstein to dinner at Buckingham Palace shortly after Epstein's house arrest ended. Epstein writes in an email that he's in London. The account labelled Duke replies, I'm just departing Scotland, should be down by 1800. I'll ring you when I get down. Alternatively, we could have dinner at Buckingham Palace and lots of privacy. It's signed A. And Epstein replies, BP, Buckingham Palace, please. It's not clear if that dinner took place, and the BBC hasn't been able to verify the authorship of the emails. And important to point out, we have approached Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor for comment, but he hasn't responded and has previously strenuously denied allegations of wrongdoing connected to Epstein.
I just wonder whether The people involved will have known that there's some of this material still out there and would at some point surface, which kind of retrospectively makes sense of some quite aggressive moves to, you know, strip him of his titles last year.
Yeah, because last year Andrew was stripped of his titles. We know he's got to move out of Royal Lodge. What we had is really years and years of drip feed allegations about Andrew and Epstein, really prompted by that Newsnight interview. And over the years, the palace really didn't want to get involved for a period of time. But then the king did take decisive action towards the end of last year, I think with the knowledge that there was going to be these documents coming out, that more information was going to come out, there was going to be more embarrassment for Andrew and the palace, and they were keen finally to try and shut that down.
Yeah, OK. Simon, thanks. Simon Jones, our correspondent.
18 minutes past seven now. Keir Starmer's visit to China has come to an end. He is now heading for Japan. Now, for a trip designed to reset Britain's relationship with Beijing and to strengthen economic ties. Was it job done? Jack Fenwick is our political correspondent and joins us in the studio. Jack, I mean, how big would you say the wins were for Keir Starmer? The government seems to be talking up the opening of shops selling Labubu dolls as one positive outcome of the visit.
Yeah, that's the thing that the government is mainly talking about this morning. Seven of these Labubu shops. These are these spike tooth dolls that went viral last year. You may remember people were queuing around street corners to try and pick them up. And other deals that were done involved a cut in tariffs on Scottish whisky exports, a Chinese car manufacturer opening its European HQ in London. I think in truth, all of those individual deals were pretty small. I mean, Downing Street are telling us that overall the export deals signed on this trip are worth £2.2 billion. They're saying that the market access gained is going to be worth another £2.3 billion to the UK over the next 5 years. But they haven't given us all the details on exactly what is involved in those figures. Away from the pure economics, we also know that as part of this trip, Chinese sanctions on six British parliamentarians were lifted. That is something the Prime Minister is pointing to as a real win, although one of those parliamentarians did tell the BBC yesterday that they thought that was a meagre return for the UK.
I mean, it looks like after this trip, the relationship between Britain and China is only going in one direction, really. Where do you think this leaves those here making the case, those here who are making the case that China is not a country to be trusted?
Well, clearly, the Prime Minister is wanting to foster closer economic ties with China. He says that he wants to get rid of the so-called ice age under the Conservatives. I mean, the Conservatives also, I think it's in their interest to point out closer economic ties as well with China. They appear to be much more hawkish on China than when they were in office. I mean, on the issue of national security, actually, when you speak to people in the security world, they don't think that the relationship between the UK and China has changed that much from the Conservatives to Labour in terms of national security. No doubt the Conservatives will go on to say that they don't believe this trip should have happened and was a success because of those issues around Chinese espionage in the UK. But Keir Starmer is trying to say that doing things like this abroad will help out with the cost of living at home.
Jack, thank you. Jack Fenwick, our political correspondent.
Well, we're talking to the former head of MI6 about Iran at 10 past eight, so we might try and get a question to him about how he sees the situation in China. But first, a minister told peers yesterday the government will definitely not be bringing forward an assisted dying bill itself if the current one fails in the House of Lords. Now, that bill would allow adults in England and Wales with less than 6 months to live to be helped to end their lives. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, who's Susan Hume.
Earlier this week, one of the bill's sponsors, Labour's Lord Faulkner, told this programme that he thought the bill would fail, that some peers were filibustering to delay it, and maybe the mechanism of the Parliament Act might be used to bypass the Lords to make assisted death legal. That interview had possibly ruffled some feathers back at the office.
Of course I would defend to the death the noble and learned Lord Faulkner's right to appear on the Today programme.
There was a but coming.
He threatened, though I don't think it's in his power, he threatened the Parliament Act. He threatened us with the Parliament Act. But more particularly, he said that what was going on in all these proceedings was just a filibuster.
Something Lord Moore, a non-party peer, said was quite untrue. At the moment, the government says it's neutral on assisted dying, and the government chief whip, Lord Kennedy, was clear that he had no plans for the government to shoulder the bill and make it law in the future either.
I'm going to say to the House, I have enough problems getting the government's programme through at the moment, let alone
trying to deal with this bill. So I promise you, it's not going to come back as a government bill.
Turning to the bill itself, some peers wanted to make sure consultations with people about having an assisted death were face-to-face rather than conducted by video link or phone. A Conservative, Lady Coffey, was worried about coercion.
What happens when people are making a declaration? Are we sure that somebody isn't in the room? Giving them the eyes, that they'll do the right answers, as opposed to understanding whether coercion can happen or not.
But the non-party peer, Lady Gerada, who's a former president of the Royal College of GPs, disagreed. Video allowed patients and families to be together for those assessments.
During COVID, my lords, I assessed thousands of patients' capacity, consent and safeguarding issues remotely, with no evidence of increased coercion or harm.
Others weren't so sure. A Lib Dem, Lady Smith, described her father's experience during COVID when he had a phone consultation about his jaundice.
The doctor had never met him, and the doctor's message, or the message my father took away, was, it's pancreatic cancer. And my father then spent weeks saying goodbye to all his relatives.
But he didn't have pancreatic cancer, and she felt remote consultations left more room for misunderstandings. Another Lib Dem, Lady Pidgeon, insisted video consultations had come along hugely since the pandemic.
We in this House must be careful. We're standing in the way of technological process, and at times reading some of these amendments, I wonder whether actually people might just want to put down, add in, that we write in feather, quills and ink, because it seems that's what this is really about.
Lord Faulkner, the bill's sponsor, responded to concerns by promising to go away and come back with a solution
that indicates when face-to-face is appropriate or face-to-face should normally be the norm, but here are the circumstances where it wouldn't, because I get the sense of anxiety about that.
And as for using the Parliament Act to get round the Lords and make assisted dying legal, Lord Faulkner said that was the last thing he wanted to do.
Susan Hume reporting there. Now, we have been celebrating the National Year of Reading here on Today, and we've been asking some of our best-known writers about a book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. Today, it's the novelist Sarah Waters, known for books including Fingersmith and Tipping the Velvet. She has chosen The White Mountains by John Christopher, first published in the UK in 1967 by Hamish Hamilton.
Well, I was already a bit of a reader by this point, but my reading, I think, hadn't been terribly sort of sophisticated. But our classroom at school, this was in the last year of junior school, had what I remember as a really quite substantial little library of books for us to read. And I must have picked up The White Mountains maybe by chance, really. But as soon as I started it, I was absolutely gripped by it. One of the things I loved about it was it reads like a historical novel at first. It's narrated by Will Parker, a miller's son. He's 13. The setting seems to be medieval, but gradually these odd details creep in, and we discover that the book is set not in the past, but in the future. The Earth's been taken over by giant alien tripods who are keeping humanity docile by fitting a brainwashing mesh cap to the head of every boy and girl when they turn 14. So Will has to escape and join the resistance. He has to trek across France to the Alps. It just blew my mind. I mean, the other girls in my class, you know, my friends at school, were reading Enid Blyton, Mallory Towers and things like that. And this just felt like in a completely different league. I'm going to read an extract that comes quite early in the book. It's capping day in Will's village, and Will's slightly older cousin Jack is about to be capped. We don't quite know what that means yet. He's been dressed in a special tunic. The church bells are ringing, a special capping peal. Everyone's gathered outdoors, excited, waiting for the ceremony to start. At last we heard, above the clang of bells, the deep staccato booming in the distance, and there was a kind of sigh from everyone. The booming came nearer, and then suddenly we could see it over the roofs of the houses to the south, the great hemisphere of gleaming metal rocking through the air above the three articulated legs, several times as high as the church. Its shadow came before it and fell on us when it halted, two of its legs astride the river and the mill. We waited, and I was shivering in earnest now, unable to halt the tremors that ran through my body. Sir Geoffrey, the Lord of our manor, stepped forward and made a small stiff bow in the direction of the tripod. He was an old man and could not bend much nor easily. And so one of the enormous burnished tentacles came down, gently and precisely, and its tip curled around Jack's waist and it lifted him up, up, to where a hole opened like a mouth in the hemisphere and swallowed him. It's great, isn't it? I still find that moment exciting. I really do. The mix of futurism and something that feels like historical fiction, as a child, I just loved it, and I still find it great. John Christopher was a terrific storyteller. He writes very visually, and he does what I think all good sci-fi and historical novelists should do. He creates a world that feels big and convincing and complete and immersive, even though we're only seeing part of it. You know, as a novelist, I've tried to tell immersive stories. I've tried to write visually. I've tried to write with pace, you know, creating moments of tension, revelation and surprise. So I feel I couldn't possibly have written the kind of books I do without having first discovered the power of storytelling through books like The White Mountains, you know, through other authors' books when I was a child. And I feel very grateful to that that classroom in St. Edward's Primary School, Middlesbrough, back in the 70s, that they did have this great collection of books that I was able to pick my way through.
Another one to add to the never-ending list of recommendations. That was Sarah Waters on the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading.
It's 28 minutes past seven. There's been some gripping and some grueling tennis matches involving pickle juice at some point. And Leila and I are going to try some pickle juice later to see whether it gets us through to the
Can't
end of this programme.
Yeah.
It's all about the Australian Open, but also some cricket news this morning, Simon Mundy.
There is. Just a little bit of advice on the pickle juice. You know, you're only meant to swill it round your mouth, not swallow.
Are you not?
Yes.
That's very handy.
Like essential,
you did say that.
Essential.
I would happily have downed it.
It's fricking the brain.
Have you seen the size of the bottle as well that they've got in store?
No drinking, just swill it round. Anyway, but as you say, cricket first. Yeah, England cricketer Harry Brooks admitted teammates were present on the night he was involved in an altercation with a nightclub bouncer in New Zealand just before the Ashes. Brooks says he regrets previously lying about being on his own to protect the others as the cricket regulator investigates the incident. Meanwhile, England won by 11 runs over Sri Lanka in Palakkale. It was the first of their three-match T20 series. To the Australian Open, though, where the tournament really did burst into life with two epic men's semi-finals yesterday. Carlos Alcaraz overcame cramp and Alexander Zverev to reach his first final down under after a five-set thriller, which was the longest last four match in Australian Open history. Then Novak Djokovic rolled back the years to beat double defending champion Jannik Sinner, also in five sets. On the line in Sunday's final, two records. Djokovic going for Grand Slam title number 25. That'll be a standalone record in the men's and women's game, while Alcaraz is looking to become the youngest man to complete the career Grand Slam. And we can speak to BBC commentator and presenter Gigi Salmon now. Morning, Gigi.
Good morning. Can I just say, don't try pickle juice. The Australian Open a couple of years ago, I downed it because it's a shot. You are actually meant to consume it. Okay. I didn't have cramp, admittedly. It was disgusting.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I was reading an article yesterday that says you're meant to just swill it around your mouth, Gigi, because then it tricks the brain into cramp. But let's not get stuck there because we've got more important things to discuss. The tournament had been somewhat underwhelming before yesterday's matches, but really two semi-finals for the ages.
Oh, it was ridiculous yesterday. We had 9 hours and 36 minutes of blockbuster action. It started at 2:30 in the afternoon and it finished at 1:30 in the morning. You had Carlos Alcaraz, who had cramp, and Sasha Zverev, the world number three, was saying, well, he can't be treated. That's not allowed. Why is he getting treatment for cramp? And then Sasha Zverev said, well, he didn't play well for an hour and a half, the Spaniard, but he let him get into it. Zverev had the opportunity to serve to be back in the Australian Open final, but somehow Carlos Alcaraz managed to find his way through for his first Australian Open final. As you mentioned, he's looking for history to become the youngest ever player to complete the career Grand Slam. And then Novak Djokovic. Nobody had given Novak Djokovic a chance against Jannik Sinner. And then he comes through in five sets. That was 4 hours and 9 minutes. He rolled back the clocks. He rolled back the years. It was absolutely incredible.
You say no one gave him a chance. I've got to be honest. I thought he had a shot because he conserved so much energy. He was really fortunate. He's spoken about needing to be fresh when he reaches the latter stages, and having that walkover and then a withdrawal definitely helped him.
It's interesting in hindsight, isn't it, to say he had a chance, but I know
I
what
did.
You mean.
I've got the text to prove it.
The first three rounds, as you said, they were straight sets. Then Jakub Mensik pulls out. But against Lorenzo Musetti, he was basically on the plane home. He said it himself. He was trailing by two sets to love before the Italian became injured, and then he couldn't continue. And Djokovic said, I've had an absolute lifeline. So, yes, he'd conserved energy. But Lorenzo Musetti's best is normally nowhere near the best of Jannik Sinner, who he would then face. But the way Novak Djokovic took it to Jannik Sinner, the way he stayed in there, he battled with some breathing problems at one stage during that match. He is a fighter, we know that. He has the belief and he has the confidence. But who would have thought at 38 years of age, 39 this year, that he would have a shot for Grand Slam title number 25, booking his place in his 38th Grand Slam final?
Yes, amazing. And what's going to be interesting is who the fans will be behind, because normally Djokovic is on the receiving end of some barracking, even in Australia, but the fans really appreciated him yesterday. But against Alcaraz, who is the crowd favourite more broadly, like Federer was back in the day, who do you think is going to have the lion's share?
I think it's going to be Novak Djokovic. There's a very, very large Serbian community. There always has been in Australia. They come out in force to support him. And I think the more neutral fan is appreciating what Novak Djokovic is doing. And we were having a chat. Why haven't they shown that appreciation earlier in his career for what he's achieved? But I think people are really seeing what he goes through to be playing this kind of tennis at this kind of level at this stage of a Grand Slam. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal what he is doing against the players we have at the very top. So I think it's going to be an amazing atmosphere. But if I had to call it, I think there'll be slightly more cheering for Novak Djokovic.
And just in one name, who's going to win?
Carlos Alcaraz.
Gigi Salmon, thank you very much. We'll be discussing the women's final in an hour's time.
Simon, thank you. Now, it is coming up to 27 minutes to 8. Paddy O'Connell is here with us to give us details of tomorrow's broadcasting house. Morning, Paddy.
Leila, hello. Good morning, and good morning to you. Well, the Rafah crossing into Gaza is due to open tomorrow. We will report from there live. We're on Iran watch, as is the world. Back home, the number one TV hit on streaming services could one day be filmed in Northern Ireland, so its lead actor tells us. We meet a woman who was in the audience, did you hear about this, for Turandot when a last-minute replacement was made for the tenor singing Nessun Dorma. There was that strange mix of bawdy British behaviour and posh opera booing. Booing. And we're all ears, Leila, for your item on pickle juice. Personally, I recommend, when listening to today, large quantities of prune juice. So I should be swapping.
We've got advice coming at us from all directions. Thank you, Paddy.
Thank you, Paddy. Let's have a quick look at the weather today. Largely cloudy with outbreaks of rain and showers for many. Southern and eastern parts of England will see some sunshine.
Now, at 26 minutes to 8, you are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Leila Nathu. And Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Email exchanges from 2010 suggest the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein wrote to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to set up a dinner with a woman the disgraced financier described as Russian and beautiful. The messages are among more than 3 million pages of documents released by the US Department of Justice after it was ordered to make public all its files on Epstein. BBC News hasn't been able to verify the authorship of the emails and has asked Mr. Mountbatten Windsor for his comments, but he hasn't responded. He's previously strenuously denied all allegations of wrongdoing. The documents also contain some allegations made against President Trump by callers to a national FBI tip line. Many appear to be unverified and made without supporting evidence. The Justice Department said they were false and Mr. Trump has denied doing anything wrong. And emails by Epstein also allege that the co-founder of Microsoft, Bill Gates, contracted a sexually transmitted infection from Russian girls. A spokesperson for Mr. Gates said the claims were absolutely absurd and completely false. Emails have emerged from Britain's former US ambassador, Lord Mandelson, requesting to stay at Epstein's New York apartment in 2009 when he was business secretary and when Epstein was serving a prison sentence in Florida. It understood in the end that he didn't stay at any of Epstein's properties at that time. Lord Mandelson told the BBC he was never culpable or complicit in Epstein's crimes. In other news this morning, a partial shutdown of the US government has begun, despite the Senate passing a compromise deal yesterday. It still needs to be approved by the House of Representatives, which won't meet until Monday. The Prime Minister will hold talks with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo later today after completing a three-day visit to China. Sir Keir Starmer will meet Sanae Takeuchi just a week before Japan heads to the polls in a general election. And stars of television and film have paid tribute to the actress Catherine O'Hara, who has died at the age of 71. She had roles in Beetlejuice, Schitt's Creek and Home Alone.
Thank you, Charles. Financial markets have been all over the place, all over the world this week. Gold and silver saw record rises, then some spectacular falls at the end of the week. The dollar hit lows and then started bouncing back yesterday. And with that backdrop, President Trump announced his pick for perhaps the most important non-elected official in the world, the chairman of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, which controls the availability, the cost of borrowing the world's most important currency. The president picked Kevin Warsh to be the hand on the global financial tiller. We can speak to Mohamed El Arian, president of Queen's College at the University of Cambridge, eminent economist, chief economic advisor at Allianz. And you've known Kevin Warsh personally for nearly 20 years, I understand. And I'm going to ask you, Mohamed, just to park the person for a moment. He steps into a very sensitive moment, the Trump plan for the US and world economy. How does he fit in to that picture?
So good morning, Simon. It certainly is a challenging situation because he inherits a highly divided committee that makes interest rate decisions. And he, and of course, we know that President Trump is impatient. He would like to see interest rates lower. How does he fit in? He fits in well. He has deep expertise in economic and financial issues. He has board experience. He's a good communicator. And most importantly of all, he understands the need to modernize and reform the Fed. Unless this Federal Reserve is reformed, it will be very vulnerable to political attacks. So you have someone coming in that once they impose their authority, which will take time, should put the world's most important central bank in a better place.
And that's crucial, isn't it? Because a lot of people thought that the relentless attacks on Jay Powell, the former or the current until May chairman of the Fed, he was called a numbskull, a moron, too late to bring down interest rates. And a lot of people feared that the White House would eventually capture the Fed. Is he the independent Federal Reserve chair that people want?
I think mostly yes. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is he is very open about the mistakes that the Fed has made, and the Fed has made mistakes. And he understands that independence comes with accountability. Second, he is known to not to be a dove on interest rates.
That means someone who generally favors lower interest rates.
Correct. And he has done a lot of work in terms of how do you evolve the Fed so that it meets the challenges of today and tomorrow. And the most important challenge is adapting the economy to these transformational innovations in AI, in life sciences, and in robotics. He will inherit a Fed that unfortunately has been very backward-looking, and he's going to try to get the decision-makers to coalesce on a forward-looking vision for monetary policy and the economy.
Mm. One of the things that people worried about, and one of the reasons gold was rising so quickly, was that people feared that if a Trump, for better want of a better word, stooge got in and did his bidding and lowered interest rates, that could unleash inflation, which would favour gold and would be a problem for the dollar. Does this mean that a more sensible person or someone who's not going to be a Trump stooge is in place?
So he is very respected, and you saw the reaction in markets. The dollar strengthened, interest rates slightly edged higher, and of course, gold and silver came down significantly, as you mentioned. Part of that is just speculators being monetizing their profits after an incredible surge in prices. Generally, he is viewed as a very credible candidate, and unlike the other Kevin, Kevin Hassett, so it was down to two Kevins for most of this race. Unlike the other Kevin, he's not seen to be very close to President Trump.
That's interesting. And implications for the UK, where does the UK sit in this global order? Because it does feel like the plates are shifting, that the big American plan was to weaken the dollar, make their exports more attractive to the rest of the world, make imports into the US more expensive and therefore less attractive, to try and revitalize America's industrial base. Where does the UK sit in all of that?
So it's also good news for the UK. What we've learned over the years is that if the US central bank sneezes, our financial markets in the UK catch cold because we are more vulnerable to external dislocations. So to the extent that this will put the Fed in a better place, that this will secure its political independence, it means that we at least will have fewer neighborhood effects, as I call them, fewer disruptions coming from outside. And then the UK can control more of its narrative, more of its outcomes.
OK, let's complete our world tour. So I've still got you. The yen in Japan. Some people saying that the Japan is about to have its Liz Truss moment in the sense that unfunded tax cuts could put their budget in trouble when they already have debt as over 200% of their national income.
Yes, and there was concern. We saw the yields, the interest rates on Japanese bonds go up sharply and in a rather disorderly fashion. However, I want to stress, however, Japan is in a better position than most others to bring this back. The reason why people are so focused on this, Simon, is because Japan owns a lot of foreign securities. And the last thing you want is Japan to be selling your security, whether it's gilts, whether it's U.S. treasuries. This is an important reminder to governments around the world that in the last 3 years, the bond market has got uncomfortable with three of the G7 countries, the seven top countries in the world. In the old days, Simon, as you know, the bond market would get uncomfortable with developing countries. Mm. Now, the bond market has gotten uncomfortable with the UK in 2022, France and Japan.
We're going to have to leave it there. Mohamed El-Rayan, thank you for that world tour around the world bond market. So we have a new player on the pitch in Kevin Warsh, the new chair of the Federal Reserve in the US.
17 minutes to 8 now. Ukrainians are bracing for temperatures to plummet this weekend. It is bitterly cold there at the moment. Russia has paused strikes on Ukraine's energy grid amid warnings of a potential humanitarian crisis, with President Trump claiming credit for that, having called Vladimir Putin personally. President Zelensky said yesterday that Ukraine had reciprocated and refrained from attacking Russia's energy facilities too. Sarah Rainsford is our correspondent in eastern Ukraine. And Sarah, just give us a sense of how bad the situation has got for people, hundreds of thousands in the dark and have been without heating.
Yeah, the situation extremely difficult, and of course particularly so because of the cold weather here. We're in the Kharkiv region now. It's about -8 at the moment, but the temperatures are forecast to plummet down below -20 tomorrow overnight. So extremely, extremely cold. That's on the street, but it is also extremely cold in so many people's houses. Yesterday we were at the house of one lady who has had no heating or electricity, mains electricity, for several weeks now. It just comes and goes, the electricity, for a couple of hours a day. Now she's sitting there in her coat and in her hat inside her house. She is warming water on the gas and putting it in saucepans with her toes on top to stop them from freezing. And she is also trying to heat bricks because bricks hold the warmth a little longer. So desperate life hacks essentially here in Ukraine to try to keep warm inside houses, inside blocks of flats across this country, because these attacks on the energy system have been deliberate and they've been repeated, and they are basically creating havoc with the heating and the power systems here. And however hard the engineers work throughout the day and throughout the night to try to repair the pipes and try to restore the electricity, it's a massive battle. So any kind of pause in those huge missile strikes on the energy system are very welcome, and certainly we haven't had a massive attack overnight. It's been a couple of days, or in fact it's been a week without a major attack on the energy grid. But I have to say, although Russia says it's pausing its attacks because Donald Trump asked them to, there usually is a gap of a week or so between massive attacks, so it's hard to tell whether Russia's actually done something actively to stop the attacks and whether or not this pause will really last.
Sarah, many thanks for that. Well, let's talk to Oleksandra Azarina, who is the former Deputy Minister of Infrastructure in Ukraine and sits on the Economic Security Council there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you give us a sense of how badly damaged Ukraine's energy infrastructure has been by the sustained Russian attacks on facilities?
We definitely can say that this winter is the worst. So we had different types of the attacks since the 2022. And frankly speaking, that's the moment when we're really low in ability to produce the energy, but also an ability to transport it. And the biggest thing which worries now a lot is the fact that the Russians are trying to cut half of the country, which is the left bank, like a region which covers left bank from the Dnipro River, can be cut from the major energy generation, which is now our nuclear power station. And we can speak about like 15 million of people being targeted to get cut from them energy supplies. So that's the most worrisome. I could say that the last week was essential to rebuild major capacities. And we all like are living here in Kiev or in Kharkiv. We can say that during the last few days, the energy came back bits of bits because for quite a long time we had only like a 2-4 hours per day. Now it's around like a 7-8, so it feels already quite good. And yes, it's a lot of skepticism around here about the possibility to have pauses, you know, just like they're, you know, collecting more missiles. But we all keep repeating here that, you know, the winter isn't forever. It's not, you know, Narnia.
How easy is it to make major repairs during these moments of respite? Is it possible to get for the grid to get back to normal, or has there been really catastrophic damage sustained?
It's all about, you know, day-to-day heroism of the people working on their places. And the last 2 weeks, all the professionals, both from the public and the private companies working in the energy generation facilities, energy transportation facilities, they were working 24/7. There are lots of stories about the special equipment being used and the people were, you know, repairing one of them, Kyiv's power stations under the water, under like minus 15 degree. So it's just incredible heroism. So like if we judge from the normal point of view, it's just impossible. If we judge it from the point of view that we are fighting for our lives, for our normalities, yes, that's what we are doing. And it seems we are succeeding.
And presumably it's affecting businesses and industry as well, the damage to the energy facilities.
Definitely. That's, frankly speaking, one of the things which worries the most the experts, because I mentioned those 15 million of people which could be cut from the energy supplies, and we do hope that it will not happen. But look, like a peak hour electricity demand, like in during the winter times, is around 16 gigawatts. Like a domestic generation expects it to be around 10.6. And there is still a huge capacity deficit. And add to this the energy. What we can see from our maritime trade, since October, we already see worse numbers of the trade of the steel production coming out from Ukraine, because of the energy cuts and the energy, which are very, you know, like energy consuming, they are suffered the most. So that's really, economy is damaged.
Okay, Oleksandra, thanks so much for bringing us that. Oleksandra Azarina there, former Deputy Minister of Infrastructure in Ukraine.
11 minutes to 8. Let's get some thoughts for the day. It is time for thoughts for the day. The speaker this morning is Brian Draper, Associate Lecturer at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity.
Good morning. This week I saw a trailer for the new BBC TV adaptation of Lord of the Flies. Perhaps you studied William Golding's dystopian novel at school. It's been one of the most popular on the curriculum for the last 70 years. A group of 1950s schoolboys are stranded without adults on a Pacific island after an air crash. Led by Ralph and helped by Piggy, they start to organise and govern themselves. But Jack, the hunter, grows hungry for power and thirsty for blood too, and draws the others away from the group towards savage tragedy. It's a painful narrative, lamenting our loss of innocence and the brutality of human nature. A story which entered not just the canon, but our collective psyche too. That's just how we are. Yeah, hang on, says Rutger Bregman, author of the book Humankind. Lord of the Flies is a powerful fiction, but is it by its nature true? Has anything like this ever happened to back up the hypothesis? After much research, he found a wonderful true story that was similar to begin with. A group of six boys in the 1970s who set out from Tonga on a small boat were caught in a storm and shipwrecked on a remote island for more than a year. Yet they not only survived, they thrived, working together in teams, drawing up rosters and using timeouts if they argued. Their days began and ended with song and prayer, and when they were rescued, they were in peak physical and emotional shape. The real Lord of the Flies, he says, is a story of friendship and loyalty. Golding's tale clearly speaks to much that's happening today. We should beware, for instance, of creating a monster in our imagination that we can use to set one group against another. But as for human nature, let's be mindful of the story we tell. Golding was a troubled man, which will have shaped his own way of seeing which way a heart can bend. The doctrine of original sin also skewed the way we see ourselves. Yet the Bible starts with God creating us good, which is a story worth redeeming. There's goodness in our spiritual DNA, which tends us towards love if we let it. And when we look, there is goodness breaking out all around us, especially in harder times. People standing up for others on icy streets in protest, or helping at food banks, or just being there quietly for a friend. And even if we feel torn between a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other, daily we have a guiding choice, which for me cuts to the heart of the story of what it means to be human. See, I have set before you life and death, says God in the Bible. Choose life so that you and your children may live.
That was Thought for the Day with Brian Draper, Associate Lecturer at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. It is nearly 7 minutes to eight.
Now, if you were listening to the programme yesterday, you will have heard that we devoted a big chunk of it to considering children's screen time, their use of social media and phones, and how to approach this as a parent or carer. We had absolutely loads of messages about screen times, particularly for very young children, under fives. Now, the government is in the process of drawing up the first official guidance to parents of children in this age group on how long they should spend in front of screens. Joe and Mo are among those who got in touch with us. They are parents to a five-year-old boy, and they wanted to give us their views.
I think screen can be a really, really useful tool. Of course, you don't put your child in front of a screen all day and walk away. We have to be looking at them. We have to be engaging with them, engaging with what they're watching.
We played video games from an early age, and he benefited a lot from it. So his dexterity with his fingers, he developed that really well and really quickly because he was using controllers. It didn't affect him academically. He's way above average for his age.
I think the other point to raise as well is that it's what are they doing on screen as well, right? So watching Paw Patrol, which is like, you know, bright flashing lights, really high energy, high moving, versus a show where there's like a lot of lessons about leadership, about emotions, etc., is really, really different.
Well, let us talk now to Professor Sam Woss, Director of the Institute for the Science of Early Years at the University of East London. Good morning.
Hi, Leila.
I mean, we could talk so long about this. We don't have super long, but I just want to start with some research that was published by the government at the start of this year, which showed that 98% of under twos were in front of screens on a daily basis. I mean, that suggests that, you know, there's no going back from that, is there?
Yeah, definitely. And there have been, with early year screen content in particular, there have been massive changes, particularly since iPads and iPhones came out in 2009 and 2010. You know, other headlines from that same study, two-year-olds watch for an average of 127 minutes a day, and the top 20% watch for an average of 5 hours a day. So there really are kind of very high levels of exposure that are coming through. And one of the things that's particularly interesting, and we're looking at particularly in the screen time review, is a change in the type of content. So away from what we call kind of long-form content, so a 25-minute episode that you'd watch an iPlayer, towards YouTube. So 91% of 3 to 5-year-olds watch YouTube, which has much more different, kind of very fragmented content. And also kind of the visual information is very different in structure. So that's important, Ailey, because there really are big differences in you know, the type of content that young brains need and that they benefit from. So it's a very, very different debate to the debate with older screens.
Right. So, I mean, it speaks to what Joe and Mo were saying there about, you know, watching different things. So there is such a thing as sort of good and bad screen time for the under fives.
Yeah, definitely. So the reason, Leila, is that kind of basically our brains are prediction machines. So every word that I'm saying, your brain is generating a prediction. And every time you shift your gaze 3 times a second, your brain guesses what it's going to see before you look. So that's kind of fundamental to how all brains work. But for young children, this process works very differently. So my 46-year-old adult brain makes predictions based on my extensive previous experience of what I've seen and heard before. But young children don't have so much experience. So to start with, the neuroscience is clear. They need things that are easy to predict. So they need things that are slow paced and repetitive, doing the same thing over and over again. And then as we get better at making predictions, we naturally seek out unpredictability. But what's important for screens in early childhood is that screens give us exactly the opposite of that. Mm. So it's not just that what we consume on a screen is much more fast paced. It's that the density and complexity of screen media for young people is going up over time. So kind of changes in light intensity and sound intensity, but also, you know, more people, more objects on screen, more plot. And that's especially true, as I say, for short form video. So it really is a very different different debate for early years compared to for older children.
And I guess there's always also the argument for what it's coming at the expense of. So if kids are spending, you know, under twos are spending hours a day watching screens, they're not necessarily going out and developing their muscles physically and in the way that they should.
Yeah, definitely. So there's strong effects for that, strong effects on language, so kind of less language predictions. But the area that I'm particularly interested in that we're looking at in our research is the effects on kind of behavioural and emotional dysregulation. So we know that when stuff is coming at us that's too fast-paced and too complex, so too unpredictable, our brain says to our body, okay, we better go into high alert mode. So we trigger what's known as the sympathetic or flight or flight nervous system. So the heart starts to beat faster, we get a big release of energy to the muscles. And again, this is an evolutionary mechanism, so I can't predict what's going to happen next, so I better be ready to run, even though, you know, you're sat still watching a screen on the sofa. So this is why children are ratty when they come off screens. But we also think that spending a lot of time in this high alert mode might be why lots of studies, like the study that you mentioned at the start, are linking screen time to kind of behavioral and emotional dysregulation, and why quite a few studies are now finding these longitudinal correlations between screen use and kind of what we call affective disorders, so things like anxiety. And we think it's all kind of spending a lot of time in this kind of very high alert mode during early childhood, possibly.
Sam, absolutely fascinating. There's so much to discuss, and I'm sure this won't be the last time that we delve into it. But thank you very much for the moment, Professor Sam Wass, there, Director of the Institute for the Science of Early Years at the University of East London.
Fascinating stuff. Coming up later this morning, a quick rewind.
I'm Greg James, and I'm back with a new series of Rewinder, the programme where the stories of the week inspire a deep dive into the BBC archive. This time, we find a ping-pong-playing cat.
She's much the same as any friendly mouser, but with one important difference.
A sonic boom test.
But do you think you've achieved anything at all?
And a key dramatic moment.
No, every Linton on the face of the earth might perish before I forsake Heathcliff.
If only it weren't accompanied by quite so much background noise. The new series of Rewinder, starting this morning at 10:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
Time for a quick look at the weather. Sarah Keith Lucas is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning. Hello.
Hello, morning to you, Leila. We've got a bit of a mixed weather picture through the weekend. It's often going to be quite cloudy with some showery rain around too, but some of us today will see a bit of blue sky. And let's start with the areas that will see the driest weather. So southeast England, the East Midlands, Eastern England, as well as the northwest of Scotland. So a lot of dry weather through the day, some blue sky, but still some areas of cloud drifting around. And you might catch the odd rogue shower, and temperatures around 7 in the northwest of Scotland, 9 or 10 down towards the southeast of England. For south-west England, the West Midlands, all of Wales, across northern England, into south-west Scotland and Northern Ireland. Across this zone, we're going to be stuck under a lot of cloud today, producing on and off showery rain, not as heavy or as persistent as the rain we have seen, but still lots of flood warnings towards the south-west. So further showers, not great news. Temperatures generally about 7 to 10 degrees across this region. And lastly, today's weather for eastern Scotland, including the northeast up towards the Northern Isles. We've got cold and brisk southeasterly winds continuing to drive in some showers, some big waves around the Northern Isles too, and some snow over the higher ground in the east of Scotland.
Thanks very much indeed, Sarah. You're listening to Today with Leila Nathu and Simon Jack.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 31st of January. The headlines this morning. Messages sent by the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein months after he'd been released from jail suggest he invited Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to meet a young Russian woman in 2010. The 3 million files released by the US Justice Department also include some claims against Donald Trump. Officials said the allegations were unfounded and false. The documents also give further details of links between Epstein and the Labour grandee, Lord Mandelson.
Also coming up in the next hour, one of the most iconic fashion designers of the 60s and 70s, Zandra Rhodes, is getting the retrospective treatment.
I was waiting to see this. My original button flower design from, oh gosh, 1971.
And thank you for a 60s icon. She is still very much with us to go and see it.
They put this all on the walls. It's just incredible. They've done a lovely job.
Big blue, red, yellow
flowers. On a yellow wall. It's just happy.
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday sport. After Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz came through epic five-set semi-finals yesterday at the Australian Open, who will win today's women's final? The match gets underway in around half an hour, and we'll be looking ahead with Annabelle Croft.
The BBC News this morning is read by Charles Carroll.
Email exchanges from 2010 suggest that the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein wrote to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to set up a dinner with a woman who the disgraced financier described as Russian and beautiful. The messages are among more than 3 million pages of documents released by the US Department of Justice, together with thousands of images. It said they formed the final tranche of the files on Epstein, which it was ordered to make public. He had links with a series of high-profile figures, including Donald Trump, and killed himself while awaiting trial in 2019. Our first report on the files, by our correspondent Chichi Izundu, examines the new claims made about the former Prince Andrew and his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson.
There are a few emails in which Epstein indicates his intentions to be at royal residences, including Royal Lodge, and there appears to be an invite from the former prince for Epstein to visit Buckingham Palace. Some of these exchanges are in 2010, months after Epstein's release from prison for procuring a child for prostitution. In a chain of emails between Epstein and an account titled The Duke, Epstein says he wants to introduce the Duke to what he describes as a 26-year-old, beautiful, clever and trustworthy Russian woman because he thinks he might enjoy having dinner with her. The emails discuss the arrangements and the Duke signs his response with an A and an email signature which reads HRH, Duke of York, KG. Separately, in 2009, there are messages which appear to be between Epstein and Sarah Ferguson, where she says, I am landing in Palm Beach in a couple of hours. Is there any chance on my quick layover that I can get to have a quick cup of tea? The financier was still under house arrest when that email was sent. One document is a formal request for assistance in 2020 from US authorities asking to interview the former prince. Although he wasn't the target of the inquiry, officials say they believe he may have been a witness to or a participant in events relevant to their investigation. The BBC has not been able to verify the authorship of the emails disclosed by the US Department of Justice, and BBC News has asked both Mr. Mountbatten Windsor and Ms. Ferguson for comment, but so far neither has responded. Both have previously, though, strenuously denied all allegations of any wrongdoing connected to Epstein.
President Trump is mentioned hundreds of times in the documents. The US Justice Department insisted allegations of wrongdoing by him were false. There are also claims of a sexual nature against the Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, which he has furiously rejected. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports from Washington.
The claims about Bill Gates are from emails that appear to have been drafted by Epstein. They suggest the Microsoft co-founder caught a sexually transmitted disease from Russian girls and that he tried to hide it from his then-wife, Melinda. A spokesperson for Mr. Gates said the allegations were absolutely absurd and completely false. The claims against Donald Trump, some of sexual abuse, come from a list compiled by the FBI last year based on calls to a national tip line. Many appear to be sourced on unverified information and were made without supporting evidence. The Justice Department said they were unfounded and false. Mr. Trump has consistently denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. Many of the documents are heavily redacted, with some pages completely blacked out. There are calls from both Democrats and Republicans for full transparency, in line with the law that forced the Justice Department to release the files. But the Deputy Attorney General, Todd Blanche, said the latest release marked the end of the process, even though he acknowledged it would not satisfy the need for more information. In a joint statement, Epstein survivors said they would not stop until the truth was fully revealed.
Further evidence of the relationship between Britain's former US Ambassador Lord Mandelson and Epstein has also emerged in the documents. These include emails from the Labour peer requesting to stay at Mr. Epstein's New York apartment in 2009 when he was business secretary and when Epstein was serving a prison sentence in Florida. Lord Mandelson told the BBC he was never culpable or complicit in Epstein's crimes. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
Lord Mandelson was sacked as Washington ambassador last year when Downing Street said that emails dating from 2008 showed a greater depth to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein than had been known at the time of his appointment. Before he was made ambassador, it had previously been reported that Lord Mandelson had requested to stay at Mr. Epstein's New York apartment. Now the US Department of Justice has released messages from 2009 between the two men. Epstein suggested there might be issues with the press and mentioned a different apartment, but Lord Mandelson, who was a senior Labour cabinet minister, said he was on a private visit and the facilities were better at Epstein's home. It's understood in the end he didn't stay at any of Epstein's properties at the time. And newly released emails also show Lord Mandelson's then partner and now husband requesting funds from Epstein for an osteopathy course after the financier's release from prison later in 2009. £10,000 was sent. Emails from Epstein to his accountant in 2010 suggest further payments could also have been made. Lord Mandelson said he was wrong to believe Epstein following his conviction and has apologised to the women and girls who suffered for continuing his association with the disgraced financier.
In other news, a partial shutdown of the US government has come into effect, even though the Senate passed a compromise deal yesterday. The shutdown will continue until Monday, when the House of Representatives will meet to approve the funding. The American journalist and former presenter for CNN, Don Lemon, has been charged with breaking federal law. He was providing live coverage of a protest against an immigration crackdown in Minneapolis, which disrupted a service at a church in neighbouring St. Paul. President Trump's Attorney General, Pam Bondi, accused him of involvement in a coordinated attack on the church. Mr. Lemon said he had been there as a reporter. He spoke after being released from custody.
Last night, the DOJ sent a team of federal agents to arrest me in the middle of the night for something that I've been doing for the last 30 years, and that is covering the news. The First Amendment of the Constitution protects that work for me and for countless of other journalists who do what I do. I stand with all of them, and I will not be silenced.
The Prime Minister will meet his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo later, after completing a three-day visit to China. Sir Keir Starmer is meeting Sanae Takeuchi for dinner. Our political editor, Chris Mason, is travelling with Sir Keir and sent this report.
After 24 hours in Shanghai and another blitz of glad-handing and smiles, the Prime Minister's team hope their 3 days in China can start to reboot a sense here of British enthusiasm for engagement with the country, as critics, not least the Conservatives, question the wisdom of making the trip at all. Sir Keir Starmer is now en route to Japan for a stop of just a few hours, where he's popping in for dinner with the country's first female leader, Sanae Takeuchi. Downing Street are taking advantage of Sir Keir already being here in Asia to call in on an ally who they describe as the UK's largest inward investor outside of Europe.
The UK's first train, powered only by batteries, is due to begin carrying passengers today. It'll begin services on a 2.5-mile line in West London, using a fast charging system to top up its batteries between journeys. Theo Leggett reports.
The battery-powered train has been undergoing trials since May 2024. Last year, it set a new world record by travelling just over 200 miles on a single charge. Now it'll begin carrying passengers on the very short Greenford branch, initially on Saturdays only. A fast charging system will allow it to top up its batteries during 4-minute stops at West Ealing. Battery technology is being tested as a way of replacing diesel trains on lines which have not been fully electrified.
Tennis, and Britain's Neil Skupski has won the Australian Open men's doubles title in only the second tournament of his new partnership with the American Christian Harrison. Later on this morning in Melbourne, the women's world number one, Arina Sabalenka, will attempt to win her third singles title. From Melbourne, here's our tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller.
Neil Skupski reached two Grand Slam finals last year with his former partner Joe Salisbury, but lost them both. September's US Open defeat was especially painful as the pair had three championship points. With Salisbury taking a break due to anxiety, Skupski paired up with Harrison and they reaped an immediate reward as they beat the Australian pair of Jason Kubler and Mark Polmans. In the women's singles final, Elena Rybakina will be trying to win her first major title since Wimbledon 2022, and she has the power to match world number one Arina Sabalenka.
Russell Fuller at the Australian Open.
Thank you, Charles. 8:10. What happens next in the military brinksmanship between Iran and the US? A formidable armada is parked in and around the Persian Gulf. This is 7 months after US air power launched strikes on Iran to destroy or at least set back its nuclear program. Since then, Donald Trump has lent his support to widespread protests against the Iranian regime, protests that were put down with the deaths of thousands of Iranian citizens. What exactly does the US want? And can another military intervention be avoided? At the White House yesterday, President Trump warned that time's running out to make a deal.
We'll see how it all works out. You know, they have to float someplace. They might as well float near Iran. But it's a rough situation going on. So I stopped 837 people, as you know, last week from being hung. And I told them, if you do it, you're going to pay a price like nobody's ever paid before. And they pulled back. I appreciated that. A lot of people are being killed. So we'll see what happens. I can say this, they do want to make a deal.
Well, what might that deal look like? Professor Mehran Kamrava is Professor of Government at Georgetown University, Qatar, and Director of Iranian Studies at the Arab Centre for Research and Policy Studies. Also with us, we have Sir John Sawes, MI6 Chief between 2009 and 2014. Professor Kamrava, first of all, what is it that Iran thinks it can, what kind of deal can it, does Iran think it can do with the US, and how prepared would it be to do that?
I think the Iranians, of course, are after sanctions relief. But realistically, at this point, I think they would be willing probably to discuss limits or abandonment of the nuclear enrichment program, at least for the time being, and probably not necessarily complete severing of relations, but reducing relations with the so-called axis of resistance. The ballistic missile program, however, I think from Tehran's perspective, is a red line.
Okay, so that's interesting. You say that they might be prepared to abandon or at least postpone nuclear ambitions, cut support for proxies like Hamas, Hezbollah. That you think that is on the table?
Well, anecdotally, that's what we hear the United States wants, kind of abandonment of the nuclear enrichment program, which is interesting because the Iranian foreign minister has come out and said, well, look, we're not going to abandon it, but we're not doing it anyway because technically we're not capable of doing so, at least for the time being. And then Iran is quite pragmatic in the sense that it does understand that militarily Hezbollah, Hamas have been lost, and so has Iran lost its so-called strategic depth in Syria.
Mm. So John Sawes, is that what this is all about, essentially, is the nuclear program? Of course, there is the other issue of coming to the aid of an oppressed people, hints about regime change. Or do you feel that this concentration of military power is unfinished business from last summer?
I think it is more the latter. President Trump is making a big thing of supporting the Iranian people in their protests, but actually he failed to come to their support after encouraging them to come out onto the streets. This is actually more of a sort of foreign policy, security crisis rather than something related to regime change. And I think the professor is right that it's about nuclear program, missile program, militias. And Trump wants to extract from this very weakened Iranian regime what his predecessors failed to extract from them, which is an end to the nuclear weapons program and serious curbs on the missile program. Mm.
Do you think that the Trump camp is of one mind on their objectives here? You know, Rubio, Hegseth, his generals, etc. Because Trump, President Trump always wants a deal, a symbolic victory. I just wonder what one would look like and whether they have different ambitions.
Well, I think he is looking to extract concessions in a coercive manner. Whether the Iranians will play ball with that is not clear. The countries of the region, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and even the Israelis, are a bit cautious and reserved about American military action, but none of them have any affection for the Iranian regime. They too want the Iranians to cut back on their offensive military capacity. And so the best outcome for the countries of the region is no doubt that it is some form of deal where the Iranians step back and some of the threats that they pose in the region are reduced.
Yeah, and Professor Kamrava, how is this going to be done? How are these who's the interlocutor? Turkey has a role here because there are very few direct channels of communication.
Absolutely. Well, the traditional interlocutors have been Oman first and foremost, and then Qatar. But now we've seen a very active diplomatic role played by Turkey. And I think there might be a window of opportunity, although that window continues to close. But at least there is some sort of a glimmer of hope that there might be still room for diplomacy at the last minute.
Yeah. And do you agree with John there that the domestic predicament, that in a way that ship has sailed, if you wanted widespread support for the overthrow of the regime, that opportunity has been missed? The US was too late.
Yes, well, I think that that assumption that U.S. could intervene and effect regime change in Iran is not necessarily accurate anyway, because, and I think, Pete, there are folks in the U.S. who are aware of that, because let's say the U.S. bombs Iran, but the political establishment is firmly entrenched, it's highly institutionalized, and I doubt it would easily be dismantled.
Mm. I mean, the one simple solution for Iran, which you get sanctions lifted and much more cordial relations, start exporting oil again, improve the domestic economy, would be just to give up the nuclear program altogether. That would make life so much easier. What would stop them doing that? Is it the fact that Israel is a nuclear power?
Well, that's one.
Professor Kamrava first.
Yes. You know, I think Israel is an issue. But the problem with what you just said is that it's eminently logical. And politics is not always logical or rational. Certainly when a political establishment like the Iranians are deeply attached to an ideological and dogmatic view of the world, what you said is perfectly sensible, but that's not how the political system thinks or operates.
Mm. So, John, you had something to say?
Well, the Iranian regime will have to change dramatically at some point, or it could fall. But we're not at that point yet. We still have a regime which is well entrenched. It used extreme force to suppress the demonstrations in the last couple of weeks, and is not really paying a price for it internationally for that. But I don't think we should see this in terms of regime change. I think we should see it in terms of President Trump pursuing a foreign policy agenda where he's had some success with Venezuela, some failures, as he had with Greenland. He doesn't want to walk away from this crisis empty-handed, as he did from the Greenland crisis that he created. So I think what we're witnessing is sort of like two boxers at a weigh-in. They are posturing each other. They're full of bluster and threats, but they're not actually landing blows on one another yet. And I think the real tussle will come down the road. There may be some negotiation. I think that's what Trump really wants. But absent that, I think we should be prepared for some military action by the Americans against Iran and some Iranian retaliation, which probably won't be as telegraphed as it was or choreographed as it was back last summer.
Is that your expectation, Professor Kamrava? Some military exchange is inevitable?
I'm afraid so, because it appears that by his very actions, President Trump has committed himself to a course from which he cannot back out. And so I think at this point, to save face, to compensate for some domestic difficulties, he would have to attack Iran.
Okay. And is that, Sir John, a flashpoint for that the world should be watching incredibly closely? Of course, we will be watching it incredibly closely. But what is the peril there?
Well, the danger is that the military exchanges get out of control and escalate to a level of a wider conflict.
Who else would have to get involved for that to happen? How does that spread?
Well, I don't think other powers will get involved in any offensive action against Iran. I think that is primarily a U.S. Concern. But the Iranian retaliation would be against, obviously, U.S. bases, against Israel, against some of the oil infrastructure in the Gulf, possibly. So it could widen. And once you get into a military cycle, it's very difficult to bring it to an end. Mm. So there are always dangers when people go down this road. And the Iranian regime is highly unpleasant, highly violent, and it believes in things like martyrdom as a central thesis of the ideology of the regime. And so I think if the Americans go after political leadership like the supreme leader Ali Khamenei, then I think we could see some really quite aggressive Iranian retaliation, and that would be a threat to all countries of the region and those like us who are further away.
Whilst I have you, Sir John, just a quick thought on the recent visit by the Prime Minister to China. Clearly you had the approval of the super embassy in China, a thawing of relations there. We've been through the Golden Age, we've been through the Ice Age. Where we are now, and what you'd say to critics of the Prime Minister who say that we're playing a dangerous game with a potentially hostile state.
People make their criticisms of Keir Starmer on the domestic front, but actually internationally he's navigated things really rather well, managing a very difficult relationship with Washington, improving ties with Europe and building close links with India and other trading partners. It's a complex world out there and you have to navigate it carefully. I think he was right to go to China. He's also right to be clear-eyed about the limits of our political and commercial engagement with them. But if you're trying to grow the British economy, having zero relations with China is just a non-starter. So I think he is doing the right thing. It's an area where he's shown some skill and some progress. It's not going to change the world. It's not going to change the British economy dramatically. But it's right that he should be stepping forward and trying to build some form of understanding with the Chinese. They do pose a serious threat to us on the espionage side, on the cyber side, and we have to be very watchful on those fronts.
Okay.
But being watchful doesn't equate to disconnecting with China.
And whether you can do it all without annoying your other big trading partner, the US, of course, is the endless dance. Sir John Sawes, former MI6 chief from 2009 to 2014, and Professor Mehran Kamrava, Professor of Government at Georgetown University, Qatar. Many thanks to you both.
23 minutes past eight now. Now, we have been looking forward to this all morning. If you are in the middle of your breakfast, do try to keep it down while we talk about pickle juice. Why are we talking about pickle juice? Because during his match against Alexander Zverev in the semi-final of the Australian Open, Carlos Alcaraz was forced to take a medical break for cramp. But after a sip of this seemingly magical potion, he made a remarkable recovery, bouncing back and even hitting what some people are calling a miracle shot.
Excellent serve from Zverev. Alcaraz still in the point. The volley from Zverev. Alcaraz is there. And he's gone cross-court. And he's hit the sideline.
Oh, my goodness me.
I swear my eyes are deceiving me. The man's meant to be cramping. The man's meant to be a physical wreck.
Oh,
and somehow, he covered the ground like a cheetah. Hit the forehand cross-court.
Ready for play.
And landed the ball on the sideline.
Oh, my goodness. I have got full goosebumps after witnessing that.
So was it the pickle juice that did it? Let us ask Dr. Mehran Chordas, Professor in Sport, Exercise and Nutrition at Sheffield Hallam University. He works with Aston Villa Football Club and actually gave a Villa player pickle juice this week during their Europa League game. And we also have with us in the studio Florence Cheryl, founder of The Pickle House, who produces pickle juice on her family farm in Suffolk, which I'm very pleased to say that Simon is just cracked open.
Yeah, I noticed there was quite a bit missing from the bottle. I think the producers, our editor Tom, have been at it already.
We have been given a half-empty bottle of Florence's pickle juice to sample. Can I just clear up something first, please? Can we drink it, or are we supposed to swill it around, Florence?
Well, so contrary to what other people say, we actually drink it, and it does exactly the same thing.
Okay,
so with our pickle juice.
All right, here we go. I'm gonna taste it.
Yeah.
Okay, it's very vinegary.
You either love it or hate it. But the thing is, it's got so many good health benefits that you kind of should love it.
Okay, so it's salty and vinegary.
But my question is pickle juice anything more other than vinegar?
Well, so our pickle juice, we infuse it for 12 weeks with apple cider vinegar, sliced cucumbers, turmeric, fennel, and we let it sit for 12 weeks. So we basically pickle them. And then at the end, we strain it all out. So you get this delicious umami-rich pickle juice.
I like it.
Okay, so Dr. Ranjordas, we've ingested this, but I don't think this is the way that you're giving it to athletes, are you? You're just telling them to swill it around.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, it's a complex mechanism really on how pickle juice works, but you can drink it. But typically, you know, as an athlete on a tennis court or a football player on a pitch, I've often seen athletes, throw up when they drink pickle juice in those environments. But
they're drinking the wrong pickle juice.
it's not that bad. I have to say,
of how it works is, You want to stimulate the neurological reflex in your mouth. So once the pickle juice enters your mouth, you trigger this mechanism. And you know that face that you probably just pulled, like scrunching your mouth when that strong vinegar acidic taste. What that does is that disrupts the signals from your brain to your muscle, which is basically the muscle misfiring, which causes a cramp. And that scrunching up of your face disrupts that signal, and then because of that the cramp can be alleviated within 30 seconds.
Is it the particular taste, something particular to the pickle juice, or could it be any apparently bad taste, although I'm sure some people do really like this, but is it any bad taste that could have the same effect?
No, it's particularly pickle juice. And you know, it's the vinegar. It's the sort of that horrible sort of salty vinegar. And most of my sort of experience is the worse it tastes, the more effective it is. So we actually make our own pickle juice to make sure that we can stimulate some of these neurological reflexes in the mouth. So what we do is we infuse, we get a jar of pickles, of onion pickles, and we basically infuse it with chilies, mustard powder. And then we drain them. And the reason for that is when it's spicy and it's got that really horrible taste, then that blocks the signal immediately, and it can help an athlete continue, as you saw in the tennis match. And we often use it, you know, in some of the football players. So our particular example was that we ran out of substitutions and there was another 10 minutes to go in the match. So when a player then goes down with a cramp, you know, you need to have a pretty immediate alleviation source. Otherwise, you're down one player.
So it acts immediately?
It's within 30 seconds, yeah.
Wow.
Florence, presumably you have a market for this beyond athletes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had that theory of thought, but we also have quite a number of customers that write into us and say that our pickle juice actually works without... Obviously, it works as an immediate result as well, but equally, we've got customers that drink a shot before going to bed and it stops them getting night cramps. We've also got loads of... we have a football team in Wales that drink it. All their team drink it during half time or during the game. And it's not usually once they get cramp, it's to kind of prevent it from getting cramp. And I'm not a doctor, but it's just from the... We've been inundated with people from our customer base saying how great it is and how much it works.
So people are using it medicinally, but is there also a kind of drinks market for this? Are they putting it with juices or spirits?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I first started making pickle juice after having a pickleback in New York, which is a shot of whiskey followed by a shot of pickle juice. it sounds insane.
Yum, yum.
Okay, we'll try that in the next half an hour.
We'll have that later. It's still quite early.
Is this a byproduct of something else you're making? Are you actually making the pickles as well?
Yeah, so we made it to make the pickle juice, and it's really delicious in dirty martinis, Bloody Marys. So we also make
a
spiced tomato mix for Bloody Marys that we sell to airlines, supermarkets, loads of bars and restaurants too.
This has been an absolute revelation. So thank you very much to Alcaraz for bringing it to our attention.
And we're well set to last to the end of the program.
We are. We're powered up now. Thank you so much, Dr. Mayo Ranjordas, for being with us from Sheffield Hallam University, and also to Florence Sherrill, founder of The Pickle House.
Thank you.
Let us now hear about some pickle users, perhaps.
the tennis players out in Melbourne.
Indeed, the Australian Open burst into life yesterday with Pickle Juice swigging and Carlos Alcaraz overcoming cramped match points and third seed Alexander Zverev in five sets to reach his first final down under in the longest last four match in Oz Open history. Then Novak Djokovic beat double defending champion Jannik Sinner also in five. And to look ahead to the women's final, which starts shortly, featuring world number one Arina Sabalenka and Elena Rybakina, I spoke to Annabelle Croft just a little earlier and began by saying that while Sabalenka starts as the bookie's favourite, the way Rybakina saw off Iga Świątek suggests she's fully dialed in and flying under the radar, as she was when she won Wimbledon back in 2022.
You're absolutely spot on there. At the very beginning of the tournament, I had picked Arina Sabalenka. She's the world number one. She's been very dominant, very impressive. But, you know, Rybakina was not a name that I was really focusing on. And then when I watched her beat Iga Świątek, the Wimbledon champion, she was unbelievably impressive, not just in the way that she was serving, but the way that she hits her ground strokes and very clinical from the back of the court, very calm. And then she backed that up with a Pegula win. So I sort of feel I'm swinging a little bit more towards Rybakina, but you know what, I have a feeling it's 50-50. I think we're in for a terrific final and it's anyone's match.
Arina Sabalenka lost two Grand Slam finals and a semi-final last season before triumphing in New York. She can get tight at the business end of majors, can't she?
She definitely does. And when I was looking at her stats today, she's won 22 titles, but she's also been in 19 finals. But that means she's lost those finals. So, and you're spot on. You know, even when we think back to last year and losing to Madison Keys, no one really saw that coming. As good a player as Madison Keys is, I mean, she played lights out tennis and fully deserved to win the title last year. But I think Sabalenka was totally shocked by the loss. And then, of course, at the Roland Garros French Open final, she lost to Coco Gauff in the finals there as well. And she kind of got it back together for the US Open. But I think this is a very important final for her because we know how hungry, motivated she is. She wants to add slam. She wants to be a part of history going forward. But, you know, she does not want to lose this match today. So let's see. But you're right, she does tend to get a little bit jittery and a little bit tight.
Two obviously very powerful players from the back of the court, serves as well. Do you expect much in the way of variety to mix things up?
That's a very good question. I would say that Sabalenka has added just that little bit more variety in her game. She's added much more of a slice backhand. She's enjoying playing lots of drop shots these days. And she's pulled into her team Max Murnie, who was a fantastic doubles player. And that's to try and improve her volley skills. So I feel like she has that little bit more variety. But I also think that Rybakina has lovely hand skills. It's what we call soft hand skills, where she has an ability to throw in those drop shots. And she also does possess beautiful volleys. But I'm not sure I would describe her as somebody that brings huge amounts of variety to her game.
And just finally, Annabelle, really enjoyed your commentary yesterday, those two blockbuster semi-finals. So the final will be Alcaraz against Djokovic, both players vying for history. Who are you going with?
Oh my goodness, I'm swinging wildly all the time. I think so much depends on how they both pull up after such epic matches yesterday. It's one of the best days of my entire broadcasting career, those two extraordinary contests. But, you know, it's a big ask for Djokovic to come back. I think he himself has even said in the press conference that he feels that, you know, Alcaraz probably is the favourite. But don't forget, he beat him here last year. And it's definitely youth against experience.
Annabelle Croft, thank you very much for speaking to the Today programme and enjoy the matches.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Simon, thank you. Here is Adrian Charles with details of what's coming up on this morning's Saturday Live.
Hello, good morning. The shows I like best are the ones with a guest list that sounds like the start of a story in need of a punchline. And with that in mind, if I tell you today's guest list is as follows. A writer, a shepherdess, a neuroscientist and a clown. Mark Haddon is the writer, most famous for Curious Incident. He's written an absolutely scorching memoir. A neuroscientist is Joseph Gibrelli, who's written a book about giving your brain a rest called Why Doing Nothing Can Change Your Life. We all like the sound of that. Our shepherdess is the Yorkshire shepherdess, Amanda Owen, whose love for the farming life is undimmed. And the clown is the clown organising a church service tomorrow for many clowns to gather and honour their founding father, Joseph Grimaldi. And our inheritance tracks come today from Mika. Lots to look forward to.
Thank you, Adrian. That's Saturday Live after the news at 9 o'clock. Let's have a quick look at the weather. Today, largely cloudy, outbreaks of rains and showers for many southern and eastern parts. Get a bit of sunshine.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Leila Nathu. Now at 26 minutes to 9, Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
The latest release of files relating to Jeffrey Epstein has revealed an email exchange from 2010 in which the late offender suggests setting up a dinner for Andrew Mountbatten Windsor with a woman who the financier describes as Russian and beautiful. BBC News has not been able to verify the authorship of the emails and has asked Mr. Mountbatten Windsor for comment, but he hasn't responded. He's previously strenuously denied all allegations of wrongdoing. The documents also contain some allegations made against President Trump by callers to a national FBI tip line. Many appear to be unverified and made without supporting evidence. The Justice Department said that they were false, and Mr. Trump has denied doing anything wrong. A partial shutdown of the US government has come into effect, even though the Senate passed a compromise deal yesterday. The shutdown will continue until Monday, when the House of Representatives will meet to approve the funding. And the Prime Minister will hold talks with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo later on today. Sir Keir Starmer is meeting Sanae Takeuchi just a week before Japan heads to the polls in a general election.
Charles, thank you. Well, let's return to those files relating to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Millions more are now in the public domain. Documents, videos, images, all now being pored over. The US Justice Department said this was the final batch that would be published by the Trump administration under a law which said they must be released. Earlier, I spoke to Mary Fatilchian, an associate at the Bloom firm, which helped represent some Epstein victims, and the Republican Congressman Glenn Grossman, who sits on the House Oversight Committee. I started by asking Mary what this latest release means for the victims of Jeffrey Epstein.
We've certainly had some documents that we were anticipating be released, such as the FBI 302 files that we were looking for. It is very important to us as representatives for the survivors that we have a clear understanding of what investigations the FBI did into Epstein's sex trafficking scheme and who his potential co-conspirators are. So even after today, even after this file release, it still remains so clear that there's just a general distrust of the DOJ. And I think that the common theme amongst survivors is that whatever cautious optimism that there was for the file release has really just kind of grown into a lack of trust and this sentiment that there may be more that they are holding back.
Right. So distrust because the survivors that you represent believe that the Department of Justice has been selective with what it's put in the public domain.
That could potentially be a reason. The main reason is that obviously, Epstein was well-connected and a high-profile individual. And being a high-profile, well-connected individual, he had other high-profile, wealthy people in his social circle, some of whom who may have been co-conspirators, some of whom who may have engaged in other sexual crimes with him. And a lot of the survivors want those people brought to justice. And there has been a sentiment within our administration now that, you know, perhaps there is some protection of these people because they don't want their reputations tarnished or it's going to bring shame or embarrassment or other negative things to their life. And the main focus and worry among survivors is that those people are still being protected.
As far as the Department for Justice is concerned now, this seems to be the end. Are you satisfied that this is the end of the process?
If after reviewing the documents that were released today, if there still are things that are missing, we will not stop advocating for those documents to be released, especially on behalf of the survivors, because that is the step towards justice and that will really bring justice to them.
Glenn Grothman, are you satisfied that all of the documents that could have been released have been?
Well, I have no reason to doubt that. It's obviously going to take forever to go through them. I'm told there are a million documents or a million pages that are not released, but that individual congressmen can view them in a private setting. And I intend to look at a few, but I mean, you know, how long would it take to literally go through a million pages? You know, I'm still a little bit worried that they're hiding something and just hiding it, and that it's such a big blizzard, it might take almost years to go through everything.
From what we have seen so far, and I appreciate it's still very early days given the scale of this release, but President Trump, his name is mentioned hundreds of times. Now, of course, it doesn't immediately suggest any wrongdoing, and he has, of course, denied any wrongdoing. But how damaging do you think these sets of documents could be for President Trump?
Oh, I don't think damaging. I mean, if it were damaging to President Trump, I think President Biden would have released them during the campaign because they wanted very badly to beat Donald Trump at that time. And I think the fact that they didn't release anything during the campaign in a way shows that I don't think there's anything that's horrible for President Trump.
Some of your colleagues, Glenn, on the committee have expressed their concern about the volume of documents that have been omitted from this release. Is this the end of the story as far as you're concerned?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, I intend to look at some of the documents. I'm not going to look at a million pages of documents because they have other most important things to do. But I'm sure all the congressmen will spend some time looking at the documents. And if there are any well-known personalities in there, I think that's what really people want to find out.
Again, Glenn, I appreciate it's early days in terms of fully understanding everything in these files, but they do contain more details about the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew. Is getting Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to testify before your committee something you will still be calling for?
No, I don't know why I'd want to talk to him. I mean, I like the monarchy in England and all, but I don't consider him a person of significance in the United States. I don't know why I would want to spend time questioning him on anything.
You don't think his account of his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein would be valuable in terms of understanding Epstein's behavior?
I'm not going to lead the charge to have a hearing on him. If the committee chair wants to, he can try to bring him in. But I think that would more be the type of thing that's done to embarrass the crown and to no end, not learning anything new. So it's not something I look forward to doing.
Mary, can I come back to you? Are you looking for any further evidence in this huge pile of documents that the authorities failed to stop Jeffrey Epstein earlier?
Yes, we're looking for any evidence that the FBI neglected to investigate him, despite having credible reports of criminal activity.
And from what you've seen so far, do you think that that is something that's likely to come out in this latest release?
You know, I can't say for sure. Again, it's really those FBI 302 files that document interactions and interviews with witnesses that are very important. That's something that we'll look for. If that is something that may happen in reality, I can't really say for sure.
Mary Fitoutian, Glenn Grothman, thanks both so much.
It is 18 minutes to nine. It's time for our Saturday panel. And just to remind you, this is the moment we look back at the week's news and take a moment from the relentless news churn to try and figure out what will come out of the wash as significant in the months and perhaps years to come. And our panellists this morning are Lucy Fisher, the FT's Whitehall editor and host of the Political Fix podcast, and Cindy Yu, who is columnist at The Times and writes the Chinese Whispers Substack. So welcome to you both. And let us start then, if I may, Cindy, with you both of you on the slum visit to China. Has it been a success? What was he trying to achieve and did he pull it off?
I think it's been a relative success in the sense that it was never about quick cash or gifts, never about coming back with some kind of blockbuster trade deal, because actually that would have looked much more like the golden era times, which we know now was a bit of a mistaken policy when it comes to engaging with China. So what the trip was meant to do was just basically to restart that conversation with China, which has been so inconsistent, blowing so hot and cold, and President Xi called it twists and turns very diplomatically under the Conservative government for the last 8 years. And to say, actually, when leaders visit each other and have these conversations about what the opportunities are for collaboration, that's quite normal diplomacy.
Yeah.
So just
that's
to normalise.
So it had to be sort of high profile enough to be noticed, but not too high profile to actually sort of be that significant in a way. You had to kind of underplay it.
I think so. I mean, let's imagine if he'd come back with some trade deal that was worth, you know, tens of billions of pounds or whatever it was. I mean, A, that would have really riled up Donald Trump much more than I think the trip has so far. Donald Trump has been pretty muted about
about it, relatively speaking. And also, B, I think that would have then raised alarm bells saying, well, are we getting dependent on China once again? So it's about just normalizing China as a kind of a one part of a kind of multilateral engagement process in this power, in this era of great power rivalry, when middle powers need to kind of look out for themselves.
As Mark Carney very memorably said at Davos. Lucy, not popular with, perhaps, you know, potentially unpopular with the US, or potentially unpopular within some members of the Conservative Party as well.
Well, that's right. They've made clear that they consider this Operation Kowtow by Keir Starmer. He's the first prime minister to visit Beijing in 8 years. The last was Theresa May. But I actually think it helps him, the recent volatility of Donald Trump and his threats to NATO allies, I think, make it more sensible for the UK to be diversifying and deepening relations, both with blocs that we trust and share values with, like the EU or G7, other partners, but beyond that with China. You know, it's a rising superpower. Its power is going to become more crucial as this century drags on. And therefore, you have to engage. And all our other allies are, you know, in recent months, Carney's been there, Macron, Trump alone, although he said it's very dangerous for the UK to re-engage with Beijing, he himself is set to meet Xi four times this year.
Mm. And of course, the US trade with China dwarfs anything
course,
with Europe as well.
Of course.
Lucy, Keir Starmer has invested a lot of time and political energy in this visit and preparing the ground for this reset in relations. Do you think domestically it was the right call at this stage when his critics are circling?
I think he has framed it wrong. I think he could have made more of the idea that he is the statesman on the world stage at this significant moment of rising geopolitical tensions. He needed to kind of jet out there and be speaking to the world's second biggest economy. Instead, number 10 have tried to frame this as being about trying to solve the cost of living. And that just doesn't stack up when you look at the very modest deals. It's worth overall about $2.2 billion in exports, $2.3 billion in so-called market access wins. And just to put that into perspective, when Trump came to the UK last year, they were able to unveil $150 billion of US investment into the UK. So I think the framing of this has been all wrong. And actually, if they'd done it better, it could have shored up his position at a time when his premiership looks increasingly besieged.
Just a quick one, Cindy, with my business editor hat on, there's a couple of things like, you know, visa-free access, stuff like that, which actually at the margin, people do notice that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's immediately felt. The visa centre in London will probably be less busy once that comes in. And I also think it's important to note, and it's underrated in the story, that the 30-day visa-free travel is much more for business people than for tourists. Mm. You know, it's for your British businessman who wants to go to China to strike a deal, to talk to Chinese interlocutors, to be able to go there without the red tape of that visa process. Tourism, of course, is great, but that almost trivialises what this deal means.
Those business people I know do exactly what Keir Starmer did, and they take a burner phone with them when they go. So I'll leave that one for now.
Shall we turn briefly to something else that's going to play out over the next few weeks here, the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing as a Labour candidate in the by-election in Gorton and Denton, triggered by the resignation of Andrew Gwynn as an MP there. Lucy, where do you see this now the dust is settling on that decision? Has Keir Starmer emerged strengthened or weakened by that decision?
Well, to my mind, there was only one way that he could play this. Yes, it was a bad 48 hours of headlines, him or, you know, his allies and his patronage on the NEC, the National Executive Committee, Labour's ruling body, blocking Burnham. That didn't look great in the brief term. But look, the idea of allowing Burnham to get the candidacy and return to Parliament would essentially have been firing the starting gun on the leadership challenge. Last September, you know, Burnham came out with this big pitch about, you know, business-friendly socialism. He announced that Labour MPs were privately urging him to challenge Starmer for the crown. So to my mind, Downing Street never were going to allow that to happen. Throwing forward, now the dust is settling, as you ask, Leila, I think a key question is, if there is going to be a challenge to Keir Starmer, who could shape up to be the candidate for the left or the soft left? Burnham was the obvious option. And of course, on the Blairite right, the old right, Wes Streeting is the sort of favoured challenger. It's potentially good news for Ed Miliband. That might surprise listeners who think, what party would put in front of the electorate a candidate they've already rejected? But there is interest from some MPs there. Angela Rayner possibly, although, you know, it's said that, you know, her appetite for it maybe is not that strong, and even some people around her are urging her not to go for it. So there seems a bit of a movement on that end of the spectrum.
And just very quickly, if you will, do you fancy Labour's chances in the by-election itself? Holding that seat?
Well, it's not looking likely, and not on the strength of what I'm hearing from MPs who seem pretty reluctant to go and campaign there themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Cindy, just a reminder, I think, that it's quite hard to remember a party which has such a whopping majority, which is actually quite so divided on some of the bigger issues.
Well, yeah, and you look at the makeup of that majority from the last election, and actually in a lot of constituencies, the majority wasn't that big. Mm-hmm. And so that's quite a kind of a fragile majority. So much of the vote itself was coming from dislike of a Conservative government after 14 years. And having so many new MPs, of course, means you're going to have so much fracture very early on as well. And of course, the rise of Reform.
OK, well, thank you, panellists. That was Lucy Fisher, FT's Whitehall editor, host of The Political Fix, and Cindy Yu, Times columnist and the writer of The Chinese Whispers, Stubsack. Thanks for coming in and sharing your thoughts.
10 to 9 now. Dame Zandra Rhodes is one of the pioneers of modern British fashion. Designing since the 1960s, her flamboyant prints and radical designs have been famously worn by Princess Diana, Freddie Mercury, Jackie Kennedy and many others alongside. Now, at the age of 85, she is the subject of a retrospective show at the Holborn Museum in Bath, looking back at her career, her inspirations and intricate techniques. Nicola Stanbridge went to meet her.
I was waiting to see this. My original button flower design from, 1971. They put this all on the walls. It's just incredible. They've done a lovely job.
Big blue, red, yellow
on
flowers.
On a yellow wall. It's just happy.
Straight up to the gallery.
We go straight up.
The Holborn Museum Bath is a riot of Dame Zandra Rhodes' colourful patterns and prints. Like artworks in their own right, they unusually dictated the shape of her garments, which the US Vogue editor Diane Friedland described as wearable dreams. But first, Dame Zandra, it's tradition for you to describe your outfit.
Gosh, well, I've got my usual pink hair, lots of wonderful rings and bracelets, an Andrew Logan brooch, and a printed layered dress, blue and pink striped flowers on it. As a print designer, I'm always in print, so you'll see me as a spot of colour. You won't see me in grey and black.
So what we have here today is a very small sample of your 6,000 or so individual garments that you collected around the time of the pandemic.
I had a health scare and suddenly I founded the Zandra Rhodes Foundation to protect everything and hope that it would be suitable for museums, and it's been rather wonderful, and the V&A have decided what they want to keep and things like that. So, and that was only then that we started to go through all the boxes to find out what I had actually hidden away. I'm treated every 6 weeks for cholangiocarcinoma, I think it's called, but they've managed to keep it in check, so I'm lucky enough that I'm working. Everything's really exciting.
Describe why you chose these iconic prints. Let's take the chevron shawl.
It's from the hippie 60s and early 70s where everyone was wearing shawls.
Pink, red, swirling, and then you have another version.
I have another version which is gold with silver flowers, hand rolled, and then all the edges with pearls.
How did these change the rules of fashion at the time?
So really, it was to show that my textiles were wearable. And so I let the textile lead me as to what shape it would end up at by cutting out around the edge of the print. I just think textile design is the most wonderful thing ever, where you've got a piece of plain fabric and you do a print on it, and that is the statement. All of my designs are originally hand-painted by me, and nowadays a lot of screen printing is disappearing and becoming some roller screen, and some is now automatic. I think we're losing something. I like the fact of hand screening and doing things like that. And everything that you're seeing here is hand silk screened in my studio.
Do you still carry your sketchbooks with you? And what's currently inspiring you?
My sketchbooks, I've just come back, for example, from India. That is Jaipur with the little kids standing on the roofs and all the flags blowing. I travel with a whole lot of coloured felt tip pens. I did a trip to Morocco. This is palm tree. I might do a design with palm trees. I mean, I've been inspired by looking at flowers, or, as you can see in here, by going across America in 1976 and drawing the cacti and coming up with prints for the cactus and linking it to cowboys as well, which was wonderful.
We have 34 items here today. Wild outfits, highly colourful. Are designers as brave as this anymore?
We have some of the most wonderful art colleges in the world. In textile design and in design, we're one of the leaders, but it was sad that we left the common market. We just have to hope that our designers don't just have to leave the country to go somewhere else to get the work. But I think, as you pointed out, if the things look extreme, maybe it's the fact that we're going through a period of a lot of black and not a lot of other things. So the UK produces wonderful designers that have all sorts of different ways of doing things. McQueen, who did the most spectacular shows in different ways, so that mine just looks different because it's not black.
Nicola Standridge, we're there with Zandra Rhodes. It is 5 minutes to nine. A significant reunion after centuries of separation is happening in York, where parts of a medieval shrine dedicated to York's patron saint have been returned to York Minster for the first time in 500 years, pretty much. Dr. Jenny England is research coordinator at York Minster, and Professor Diane Perkis is historian, author and professor at the University of Oxford. So good morning to you both. Dr. England first. This is St. William Fitzherbert. Tell us a bit more about what's happening.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
St. William started out, as you say, Archbishop of York, William Fitzherbert, in the 12th century. He lived a fascinating life full of intrigue and dispute, and he was Archbishop twice, actually, and he died under mysterious circumstances. But it was in death that he kind of gained additional meaning and was recognised as a saint in the early 13th century. And we're delighted this year to be marking the 800th anniversary of his canonisation, and as you say, welcoming bits of his 14th century shrine back to the Minster for the first time in 500 years.
And this would be because, Professor Perkis, that this shrine would have been buried during the Reformation. What was going on at the time this split occurred?
Well, what was happening was that all shrines of this kind were ordered to be destroyed by Henry VIII's government. And this was actually part of what's usually called the dissolution of the monasteries. I would call it the destruction of the monasteries. As part of Reformation, there was a huge campaign against the cult of saints, and particularly the veneration of the relics of the saint, which were, in the case of William of York, buried in the cathedral. So the shrine was dismantled to discourage veneration. And what's interesting here, as I understand it, and I'm betting Jenny knows more about this than I do, it seems as if it was dismantled really carefully. It wasn't just destroyed. And instead, the pieces were buried carefully around the city, as if there was hope that in some imagined future, these pieces could be reunited and reestablished within the Minster. Mm. And that, too, is quite a common response to these big destructive tendencies on the part of the government. People actually do squirrel away holy items in barns and in their attics in the hope of preserving them. And it's wonderful that in this case, these squirreled away pieces are being reunited with one another so that a part of our past becomes visible again.
Is that true, Dr. England, that these are squirreled away so they could show their sort of Catholic face in years to come? They bet they didn't think it would take 500 years, though.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we can't fully reconstruct the motivations of those people who buried them. But as Diane was just saying, these were buried underground in the precinct. And the evidence that we have suggests that there was really careful care taken. They were buried on a bed of sand, kind of face down, to be protected. And it's a really kind of important part of their story. But it's been amazing to kind of welcome them back out of the earth, as it were. They've been in the care of the Yorkshire Museum for over a century, and we're so delighted that York Museums Trust has very generously granted us a loan for the exhibition so we can show these pieces back in their original context.
And presumably, Professor Perkis, this would have been a hanging offence. You would have been executed for this 500 years ago?
Absolutely. And people who did this were taking a personal risk. We know that in 1570, Cuthbert Mayne was arrested and immediately put on trial and executed simply for having one holy item, the Agnus Dei, which is a little wax disc that bears the impression of a lamb and a flag, like the pub name, if you've ever seen that.
No, well.
So that in itself was enough to get you killed,
okay,
because it was seen as treachery to the Protestant government.
So no executions, Dr. England. A warm welcome. When, how can people see this?
Well, the exhibition opens today at York Minster.